Hello and welcome to the Weekly Stuff Podcast with Jonathan Lack.
And Sean Chapman.
We are here to talk about stuff. This week on the show, we have so much stuff to cover.
Yes, we do.
We have a week and a half worth of news. We have Destiny 2.
Yes.
We have Metroid Samus Returns. There was a whole Nintendo Direct full of stuff to talk about that was at least interesting, if not always revelatory. So, yeah, we have a bunch of stuff to get into. First thing to say is we were off last week.
Yep.
That was our... And it's... Hey... This is like the first time in the history of the podcast I didn't feel bad about a break.
Right.
Because we'd been on since February without a single break.
Yes. We had our crazy like Persona 5 to Doctor Who and Twin Peaks to Twin Peaks rush.
Yes.
Yes. And Twin Peaks being on Sunday night had forced us to move our podcast date into Tuesday for like when we were recording it, which then eventually became kind of untenable for my schedule. So now we have shifted it back to the more normal. We're recording on Sunday night.
Yes, and releasing on Monday, which I think feels natural.
Yes.
So it means we are not reacting to the Emmys right now because they are going on as we're talking.
I mean, everyone knows us for our hot Emmy podcast episodes. Unfortunately, you're going to have to wait another week for that.
Sean, if Twin Peaks gets enough nominations next year, we're live podcasting that sucker.
Sure, yeah.
You know it. Just, yeah. If it gets 20-plus nominations, which it should.
It should just get every single nomination. It should just all go to Twin Peaks.
I mean, you could literally fill up all the acting categories in its category.
I mean, honestly, instead of having the Emmys, they should just have a marathon of Twin Peaks. That's it. That's like, just air that. That's like, and then everyone will know, okay, just got all of the awards. I understand.
You know what I want them to do in lieu of that is, you know how sometimes anime will do like the cut-down movie where they take their like 50-episode series and do it in 2 hours? I want them to do that for Twin Peaks: The Return and air it. Do the 2-hour cut down.
Yeah, see what even comes out of that.
It would be quite funny. Anyway, so yeah, I told Twitterverse to at me if there was anything interesting. Really, I just want to know if Elizabeth Moss wins or loses tonight because she should have won like 3 Emmys by now for Mad Men and Top of the Lake, and finally she's up for The Handmaid's Tale. She's probably going to win, and if she doesn't, I'm going to have to rant about that.
Sure, so, I'll let you do that.
So someone hopefully will at me. I've got my phone over here. I won't be checking it. But anyway, Sean, let's get into some housekeeping.
All right.
You already mentioned the big change that we're switching back to Monday's normal podcast schedule. Although, you know, who knows? We were on Wednesdays long enough that this is probably new for some of you. So yes.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
We had been on Mondays for years. Now we're back to Mondays, which means we'll be moving around the Let's Play schedule a little bit. Let's Plays for the foreseeable future will be Wednesday, Friday.
Yeah.
Instead of Monday, Wednesday, or Monday, Friday. So Monday, Wednesday, Friday, that means you guys are going to get Mario 64 Episode 1 this Wednesday. If you want to sign up for Patreon, there's already 3 episodes up there and more to come. So that's fun.
Yep.
Hitman episodes just went public last week.
Those are awesome.
Yeah. Did you finally take a look at those?
Yes. Yeah.
They turned out well.
Yeah.
As I said, the kill montage in my episode made me gag a little bit to edit it.
You killed a lot. I was there. I saw how many people you killed. But it does when you're like watching it back. It's like, you killed a lot of fucking people.
I want to know how they did the throat slit sound effect. Like, they probably found like a pumpkin or something and slit it across. And like, just, it's a meaty sound effect.
Yeah.
Anyway, so that's all up. More coming to Patreon soon. Doctor Who, the new episode of the Doctor Who Classic podcast, we will get that out to Patreon and everyone else as soon as possible. It's just, we've had a busy couple weeks.
Yeah.
My mom just got married, and we've had all this stuff with wedding and family in town, and just fitting in 4 episodes of Classic Doctor Who, which I need to be in the right mindset for.
Yeah.
I have not had time yet to finish it, so... But I look forward to and talking about it, because who doesn't want to talk about Patrick Troughton?
It's very good. I watched it very recently, rewatched it, I guess, for that episode.
Yeah.
Tomb of the Cybermen. 2 thumbs up. I love that episode. I love that story so much. It's
two,
really good.
2 cybernetic thumbs up.
Exactly, yes.
Yes, if we're being cheesy. All right, so that's all the housekeeping. Before we get into the news, let's do a couple pieces of stuff. One piece of stuff I want to follow up on from the previous episode is we had just gotten in the book Blood, Sweat, and Pixels by Jason Schreier of Kotaku, which is one of the first, like, real substantive books about the process of how video games are made.
Yes, it's a behind-the-scenes look of 10 different video game projects from in recent years. I think the earliest one is Halo Wars, which that's from, like, 2008, 2009.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's so rare that you get any sort of behind-the-scenes peek. There's a couple of other books, like Masters of Doom is probably the most well-known one, that's about the development of the original Doom. But other than that, like, you kind of don't have any of it. And so instead of just having, like, a little bit, it's really nice to have this book that's a, like, really nice look at the development of 10 different games from, like, a very broad spectrum of development, all the way from Stardew Valley, which is, you know, from one person, to something like Uncharted 4 or The Witcher 3 or Dragon Age Inquisition, which has hundreds of people working on touching that game over its development. Yeah.
So we've both read the book.
Yes.
And I cannot recommend it highly enough. Yes. It is a stupendous book. Jason Schreier, I already knew, was a great writer from Kotaku and stuff. But, like, these are great stories, so thoroughly researched. Everyone you would want to hear from most of the time is there. There's stuff in, like, the Destiny chapter where Bungie did not want to talk, and you read that and you're like, oh, I see why they didn't want to talk. This was a clusterfuck.
Yeah.
But, like, overall, it's so well researched, and he's such a good storyteller. I devoured this book. I read the whole thing in, like, 3 sittings. I devoured it in 2 days. It's so good. I loved it. So what did you think?
Yeah, I think it's just an awesome book. If you have any interest in video games, like that sort of, again, that more behind-the-scenes perspective, because it's something that you so rarely get any of. And every time it pops up, I, like, go at it ravenously. It's one of the things I always loved about the limited editions of the Halo games, is that they had documentaries on the Halo 2 and Halo 3 ones. And the God of War games also have some behind-the-scenes featurettes. Because you don't ever get a sense of how games are put together. And unfortunately, you really need to have some of that perspective, I think, because it's way crazier than you think it is. Like obviously, movies and, like, big-budget movies are really complicated productions, but compared to what it seems like video game development is, no matter at what level you are, it's amazing to me every time I get any of these stories about how these games got put together, because it's such mind-boggling work that demands so much creativity and technical prowess from every single person involved on the team to, like, get it to fucking work, let alone to make it fun, right?
Yeah. And, you know, it just so happened these were... So one of the games in the book never came out. That's Star Wars 1313.
Yeah. That broke my heart all over again reading that, because they reminded me of that period where it's like, oh, right, yeah, that demo was amazing at that E3.
There are 2 chapters in the book that are just straight-up tragedies, like Greek tragedies, and it's Star Wars 1313 and Halo Wars, because by the end of that, both of those teams are just gone.
Yes, yeah, that was Halo Wars was Ensemble's last game.
Yeah, and it's Jason Schreier knows how to stick the knife in. But I was going to say, of the 9 games that exist, I've played 7 of them.
Yeah.
And so it's just like it happened that I know most of these games really well, and the ones I don't were Pillars of Eternity and Halo Wars. Halo Wars I know well enough. I do want to go play Pillars of Eternity now.
Yeah.
Which just came out on PS4. But I was going to say, it helps to know the games, but I don't think you need to. Like, if you look at the list of games, like, I've only played half of these or something, you'll still enjoy the hell out of the book.
Yeah.
And maybe it'll inspire you to play some of them.
Because he does also put in footnotes in places that I thought were a nice, like, sort of, you know, olive branch to people who maybe are not super deep into video games. You have, some rudimentary knowledge, but mostly have, like, a lot of interest in these stories. I think it is still accessible, because any sort of technical terminology, even just, like, genre stuff of first-person shooter, real-time strategy, he has footnotes in there that sort of, like, gives a more layman's explanation of some of those things.
Yeah. But I also think, like, as a book, what makes it so impressive to me is that he finds a good thematic through line for every chapter.
Yeah.
Where, like, what is the story to tell? So, like, for Uncharted 4... it's kind of matching it to the video game that Uncharted 4 is about Nathan Drake realizing he works too much, kind of, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
And it's also about Naughty Dog kind of going into the worst crunch of their lives and coming out on the other side with a great game, but also, like, I mean, we're going to talk later that Bruce Straley left Naughty Dog. Kind of serendipitous that this book came out, like, a week before he did that, because I read that book and then I wasn't surprised when we got the news.
Yeah.
And then I thought the other, like, another chapter, just in terms of storytelling... I loved the Diablo 3 chapter.
Yeah, that one was great. Because that was a nice, like, triumphant story of, like, because that one's interesting because that's written from the perspective of Diablo 3 is already out.
Yes.
And it's about how do you then, after that, you know, like, the development of, like, the post-game stuff leading up to the release of Reaper of Souls and the console versions with that.
Because we both played it on the console versions.
Yes.
And I think even if you start on PC, it's really easy for us all to have forgotten that Diablo 3 had a rocky launch.
Yeah.
Because now it's one of the best-selling and most acclaimed games ever, and deservedly so.
Yeah.
But you look at that story, he doesn't go back into the original development of it. It's just we're starting on launch day, and going from there. And it's a great story because it's exciting on one level. Like, how are we going to pull, you know, get this ship right? But also, like, all the little decisions that go into how do we make a game work, but it's already out. It's like them discovering how the game works alongside the players. And you learn things in that chapter and other ones that I loved, like, that game developers, like, to a person, everyone in that book reads Reddit, and they read Twitter, and they look for, like, user input, and they know, like, what's the, like, trolley kind of stuff, but they also want to know, like, what is your thought on this game? They want to know that, because no QA testing in the world is the same as a whole audience playing it. Like, there's a great line in Diablo 3 where the director was talking about, who I came to love. There's a bunch of characters in the book you just come to love. Yeah. And the director of post-launch Diablo 3 was talking about how, you know, like, when we got to the point on Reddit where people were saying, I don't like how much damage this hammer does, I know the game is good, because that's something like, okay, we can fix that, that's easy, and it's not, this game isn't fun. Yeah. And that's, like, broad, and I don't know how to fix that. But if it's just, this hammer isn't balanced right, okay, that's, we can work with that.
It's like the normal sort of, like, video game chat room, just like, oh, no, why did you nerf my, like, dagger of mysticism or something? It's like, okay, this is normal stuff. It's like, this means that people love our game, so the only thing they have to complain about is, like, the nibbly bits.
Right. There's so much good insight like that. And the Destiny chapter, which is relevant for Destiny 2 today, and is the only chapter in the book that feels slightly incomplete just because, and it's just no one's fault, it's just Destiny 2 wasn't out yet when you wrote it.
Right, yeah.
But, like, I feel like now that's an important part of the story.
Yeah, and that's also one where not have, like, Jason Jones, who, like, is very famously does not like to give interviews, didn't talk for that section, because that also feels like, because he didn't talk for the definitive oral history of Halo thing that Waypoint did either, so it always feels like, I wish he would give a bigger interview at some point to give that perspective, because it feels like it's needed.
It's needed, and also he comes off as the villain in that story.
Exactly, yeah. When he doesn't give his voice and his perspective, like, it inevitably makes him look really bad.
Yeah, but I was just going to say, the Destiny chapter, I want to hear if you had the same experience, it was stressful to read.
Sure.
Because the Destiny chapter is a bloodbath of people leaving Bungie. Like, the body count of people who are gone from that company by the time that game ships is incredible. And it's interesting because, you know, most of the people who talked on the record are the people who had left Bungie. So you get that perspective more.
Yeah.
But it is like you see just this company kind of falling apart, and that the number one issue with Destiny 1 was this was a company making a game, and no one at that company really had a vision for what the game was.
It was, like, a lot of people had visions for what that game was, but they were not all synced up because Bungie was so huge at that point.
And I don't think anyone had one overall vision of, like, what's the one sentence pitch, what is Destiny?
Right, yeah.
They had a lot of ideas, like, what it should be, like, always online, shared universe, all that stuff, but not a lot of the details there. And you read that, and you combine that with, like, the Diablo 3 chapter and where Destiny went from there up to where the book ends and then now to Destiny 2, which I think is a very confident game.
Yeah.
And, you know, spoilers for later in the podcast. It's interesting because it's the same kind of thing with Diablo 3, I think to a greater extent, but Destiny came out as a game with no identity, and then alongside the players and the team getting to know the game, that's a game that found its identity on the fly. And that's not something, TV can kind of do that.
Yeah.
Movies and books certainly don't. It's such a unique thing about video games.
The other, specifically with that, the one thing I do love about that, the Destiny section there, because this is something I already knew, but it's so different getting it presented to you in narrative format, is that the Diablo, because they're both, Bungie is making Destiny for Activision, and Blizzard is owned by Activision, so the Diablo 3 team that, like, resuscitated Diablo 3, and that creative director who was working on the console version of Diablo 3 that then took over the PC version as well, he came over to the Bungie Studios and gave a presentation on, like, this is how we need, you guys can help fix your game because of how similar the issues were. And there's something so, because the Diablo 3 chapter was earlier in the book, it was so fun and weird to have that, like, character version of that guy enter that story and be like, right, yeah, I remember you. That's crazy the way these intersect. Which leads me to about, like, the sort of last thing I really want to talk about the book that I think is awesome is the period of time that the game or that the book takes place over and the different kinds of projects it picks, I think gives you this really interesting snapshot at a really fascinating point in time in the history of game development, which is we are now, you know, in 2017, we are at this point where the PlayStation 4 and the Xbox One and the now, like, the Switch are all extremely successful consoles. Like, the Xbox One, less so by the standards of its competitors, but by its own, the history of the Xbox brand, the Xbox One is selling extremely well, right? So we are in this point where console gaming is extremely healthy, and the kinds of games that are coming out right now, like a Destiny 2, or, like, you know, we're getting, like, Shadow of War and Wolfenstein 2 this year. We're getting the sequels to the games that were being made while this console generation was forming. So we're, like, in the heart, in the middle of this console generation where, you know, everything is kind of like roses. And I think we're feeling that in 2017 of how healthy the console business is right now. But the projects that this book talks about are mostly games that came out around 2012 to 2014. And then, like, a couple, like, Witcher 3 is, like, 2015. And there's, like, and Halo Wars is the one early outlier, that's 2008 and 2009.
But sets the stage very well for what was going to happen later.
And then also there's a number of, like, some of them are Kickstarter projects. There's the indie game with Stardew Valley. There's the canceled project with Star Wars 1313. But the games are all centered around that, like, turn of the console generation period, where it's easy to forget now how much pessimism there was about whether or not, or cynicism there was, about whether or not the consoles were going to be adopted. And you get a lot of that perspective in this book of, like, you know, talking about Dragon Age Inquisition having to be cross-generation, which is something I had totally forgotten about that game.
Yep.
Which blows my fucking mind that that game, it can be on an Xbox 360 and a PS3. Like, that doesn't make any sense. That's like, that game does not seem like it would work on those consoles at all. And it's really fascinating to see that period and get, I think, a perspective on why maybe that, like, you know, 2014 was that weird sort of dearth year of, there were good games that came out in 2014, but there wasn't the, like, broad range of really great games, and it felt like
the industry was
not as confident as it was in 2014.
Oh yeah, as a piece of, like, historical context, this book is essential because we are now in this insane, another golden era of gaming.
Yeah.
This 2016 and 2017, and kind of 2015 was the revving up year with, like, Witcher 3 and some of those games. But then you get into this year and last year have just been so off the charts insane, and I think it's going to stay that way for a long time. This is, I think, an important book to, like, how did we get here a little bit? Because, yeah, it is easy to forget. There was all this pessimism, like, gaming is dead, and now it's bigger than it's ever been.
Yeah.
And you get a lot of perspective on, okay, how did this maybe hurt Dragon Age a little bit? Or The Witcher 3 is as good as it is because it was a bunch of crazy people who took really big bets. And
yes. I do love the way that The Witcher 3 feels like, in a larger narrative of the book, The Witcher 3 is like this white knight that comes out of this, like, there's a lot of really interesting stuff in the book about, I think, details of how, like, they constructed their side quest teams and stuff that give you in, like, how they approached that material, that gives you insight into how that, compared to something like Dragon Age Inquisition, why that game came out with the kind of quality writing that it did and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But yes, it is, but it was, like, it came out of this period where there was weird pessimism in a lot of games, like a Diablo 3 or Destiny or Dragon Age Inquisition, that, like, were all good games in different ways, but all had, like, pretty severe issues.
And it makes sense for The Witcher, though, because, like, that's the games that change things have to ignore kind of the broader context and the rules and just go for it. And that's a game that I think is a sea change game.
Yeah.
And was probably, you know, the first great capital G game of the generation. So all of it, it's such a fascinating read. I cannot recommend it highly enough. You know, the only kind of piece of the puzzle that feels like it's missing a little bit is Nintendo, I would say.
Sure,
but Nintendo doesn't talk about these things.
No, yeah.
And the other thing is, I mean, I am sure developers at Nintendo run into problems all the time, and it's a tough job for them, too. You also get the sense, though, reading this book, like, maybe part of why Nintendo exists in a bubble from all this stuff, and we don't hear the horror stories, is because, I mean, one, they're a tight-lipped company. It's also that they have been around longer than anyone. They have deeper pockets than anyone.
Sure.
And just by virtue of giving time and money to the games they make, they can kind of avoid some of the really crazy shit that goes on where they're not beholden to the same set of rules. So even if they're not in the book, their absence actually made me feel like I understood that side of things better, too. Even though I love the book about, like, how specifically, because there's probably plenty of weird stories there, too.
Yeah, like, in particular, I would love one that's about the development of something like a Super Mario Sunshine. That's, like, one of the, like, more black sheep kind of, like, not to say, like, Sunshine's some horrible game, but, it's definitely an outlier in the history of their output. Because there is, like, I think, like, even just ignoring just, like, Nintendo, I think there is one, that whole of, like, there's no Japanese developer in there, which makes so much sense. I'm sure Jason Schreier really wanted to and tried to have some representation there from that side, because obviously Japanese development is so important. But
the culture he writes about there, those games all the time.
So, but the culture in Japan is not one of, you know, telling your story in that way.
I mean,
it's very much that company loyalty.
I would bet if this book came out a year or two later, he would have been able to get Final Fantasy 15 in there.
Maybe,
he's talked to Hajime Tabata a lot.
Yeah, Tabata would probably... I think he does seem like the kind of guy that would maybe be able to get that story out there.
He just copped the other day an interview like, yeah, the ending, we didn't answer enough stuff, and it doesn't really make sense. He's, like, so open about things. Yeah. I love that guy. Anyway, we spent a lot of time on this, but great
book. Blood, Sweat, and Pick Pixels, go pick it up if you're interested in that stuff. It's a great read.
Yeah. All right, Sean, the next thing on our stuff outline is I saw the movie It when it came out, the Stephen King It.
Yes, the one with the crazy clown.
Did you see this?
I didn't see the movie, no.
No, not yet. And I've actually been reading the book, too, which is really good. It's one of the better Stephen King books I've read. But anyway, the movie was very good. I don't know if I have a lot to add about it. I think it's not necessarily a great movie, but it's very, very good, well-directed by Andy Muschietti. It's, to me, like, when I read the book, I see that story less as an overt, like, horror movie with, like, the jump scares and the, you know, violin stings and all that stuff, than as, you know, I see it much more as almost in a... I said in my mind I could imagine, like, David Lynch or Terrence Malick doing an interesting thing with this kind of story, because it is so much more about, like, memory and, you know, thought process and maturity and all those things. And I think a lot of that does not carry over into the film, and that's fine. The film knew what it wanted to adapt, and it does that very well. And that's, to me, that's the most important thing about an adaptation is it doesn't have to be my vision, but pick a vision and go with it. And I think the movie does that well. The kids are all fantastic. Like, we're in a good era for child actors. There's just a ton of them everywhere.
Yeah, there've been a good, like, it's been a good couple of years, I feel, with child actors.
Yeah. And I have not seen Stranger Things, but I know one of the kids from that is in this, so there's even some crossover there. But yeah, the kid actors are all so, so good. It Pennywise, Bill Skarsgård, I think, is fantastic, and it would be on the nose, I know, but Bill Skarsgård should be in the running for whoever's going to play the next Joker. He'd be really good at it. Like, just, I can see him being like Heath Ledger, like, esque in that role, because he really disappears into it, and he's great. I think there's some really good scary scenes in the movie. There's one involving a bathroom and a bunch of blood that I think is, like, Kubrick-esque. It's very, very good. And, yeah, I enjoyed the movie a lot. I don't know if I have a lot to add, because the movie is kind of a cultural phenomenon. And it's crazy. Like, the box office for this movie just fascinates me. $123 million opening weekend in September, which, suffice to say, has never happened. $60 million second weekend, which is higher than any other first weekend in September. Like, it's just off the charts crazy. It's going to be the highest grossing horror movie in history. And I think part of it was just we were in an interesting moment where there had been 3 weeks with basically no new domestic releases. So audiences literally were just, there hadn't been any movies for 3 weeks. So it was lucky because of that. But also, clearly, this book and this story and the way they did it, I think, has struck a chord with people, which is awesome.
Yeah.
I love to see something like this do well. Especially, you know, horror movies don't usually get that big.
Sure,
which is cool.
Yeah, like, you do get, like, the... Because usually what horror movies have is that, like, they get a really, really great box office compared to their budget.
Yes.
They usually don't have, like, an amazing box office compared to other huge budget movies.
Sure, yeah. And so that's all interesting to me, but it's also, like, if this were any other property, we would assume that Warner Brothers is going to make 10 more It movies, right? Yeah. Like, and someone at Warner Brothers is talking to the team on this movie saying, we know you just wanted to do a part two, because this is the kid part, they have to do the adult part, which I'm excited for. I want to see who they cast and everything. Patrick Wilson has to be the main character, right? Anyway, but I want to see that. But I was going to say, like, that someone at Warner Brothers is like, can you make part two 3 movies? Could you do a trilogy of adult It? And hopefully they're all saying, did you guys see The Hobbit? Like, that doesn't work. And that there was more there to work off of. But no, like...
The Desolation of Pennywise.
Yes. I mean, it's just like, obviously we're going to get more Stephen King adaptations.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's necessarily the thing that's going to make them all the money. But I'm just... It's funny to think about this and be like, there will probably be some restraint. But if they treated this with the same amount of or lack of restraint Hollywood treats most hits, we would be getting the It cinematic universe any day now. And I don't know, we would have a Shawshank Redemption sequel where Morgan Freeman and other guy no one remembers from that movie, Tim Robbins, are out, like, the Pennywise comes to Shawshank and they have to fight him.
The Greener Mile.
Yes, the Greener Mile. That's when Pennywise is put on death row.
Exactly, yes, the Tom Hanks is there.
Yeah.
With his urinary tract infection.
We're going to get a 7-part adaptation of The Stand.
Oh, God.
And Pennywise is somehow going to be in all of them.
Yeah.
It's going to be crazy. But no, it's just, it's a really interesting thing to me because...
The Shining 2, Jack is back.
Yes. But it's also like, it kind of speaks to how to organically make a hit. Because we're in this period where everyone is trying to figure out, what's the next cinematic universe? What's the next giant franchise? And I think... And most of them are bombing. Like, there's not going to be a Dark Universe, Universal. Sorry. The Mummy didn't do that well. But, like, it was just... New Line and Warner Brothers were in development on this for years. They finally got the movie made. It's a good version of the movie. It's, you know, a very commercial version of the movie, which doesn't mean bad. It's just, it's, you know, it's a wide appeal kind of version. And it did really well. And really, the lesson shouldn't be, how can we make more It movies? It should be, how do we develop properties that organically become hits?
Yeah.
But of course, no one's going to learn that lesson.
Yeah, it's a combination of, like, I think, one, it sounds, by all accounts, they have made a good movie.
Yes.
Like, that's step number one, clear that hurdle. Two, put together some good trailers. And the trailers for It were good trailers.
Yes.
I remember seeing them being like, I'm not a big Stephen King guy, but those are good trailers for a movie. It's like, three, it was a property that people generally recognize and enjoy. Four, scary clowns. People like scary clowns. People go, it is a striking thing to put in your trailer and on your poster. People go see your movie if you have a scary clown and you make him look scary and he's a clown.
Yes.
It's like, if you have those four factors, you're good. Hollywood is finally going to figure it out and we're going to have just like scary clowns all over the place. I'm very excited.
You know, this is a Warner Brothers movie, or at least, I don't know, it's a New Line movie, but New Line is not really a company anymore, but it's a part of Warner Brothers,
right.
I don't know. But it's all part of the same corporate hierarchy. They've already announced, like, three different Joker movies they're making at DC. We haven't even covered all those announcements on the podcast. How soon until we get the Joker-Pennywise team-up movie, where it's Jared Leto and Bill Skarsgård, and I don't know what they do, but...
Murdered children? Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah. I guess. They haven't figured out a character for the Jared Leto Joker yet, so...
There you go.
He murders children.
I'm looking forward to the next Batman movie where Batman's, like, walking there, Bruce Wayne's gonna walking down the street, and he looks over at a drain, and the Joker's in there, he's like, ha 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 ha! He's like, what the fuck are you doing, Joker? I saw it! It was fantastic! It's a really good movie, have you seen it yet, Batman?
Anyway, fascinating phenomenon, just wanted to mention that. Sean... You wanted to do final thoughts on Yakuza Kiwami, which you reviewed on the podcast last time, but you've had more time to play.
Yes, so last time I was probably 2/3 or maybe 3/4 of the way through the game, and now I have finished it. Like, I did a fucking almost all the side quests. All the ones that I wanted to do that didn't involve just, like, too much busy work, because there are a couple of those that were like, this would be fine, but I'm going to go and do this, because there's also Destiny 2 is basically out in a day. It was when I was playing it. And yeah, Yakuza Kiwami... awesome fucking game. If you have played Yakuza 0, you have to play Kiwami. It's really, really good. And the one thing that I do want to talk about is, I think the issues that I talked about last time on the podcast are still there, of even having finished the game, of you can definitely tell that this is a 2005 fucking video game story. That's a very good story for that era of video games, but they have kind of like tried to, you know, massage that story and put other material in to kind of like... build it up and make it stronger and build the characters up and establish the antagonist better and stuff like that. And so you can definitely feel some like that story creaking a little bit. But I definitely think at the end, once you get to the conclusion and you see the, and you play the last mission and fight the last boss and see the end of that story, it kind of something clicked into place for me about the storytelling and what they've done. Of, I don't know how much of this would be true or apparent, or like if it was just something they were trying to do at all with the original version of Yakuza. But by juxtaposing Kiwami with Yakuza 0, which is set very specifically in the 80s in the bubble economy of Japan, where, you know, like, basically, it was it's kind of like pre-housing crisis America. It's like that metaphor kind of follows pretty well, that, you know, everything was going great, people were making lots of money, it's almost like Roaring Twenties or something, Great Gatsby style.
This will never end.
Yeah, in the bubble economy, it's like, it's so awesome! And then, like, after 3 to 5 years of that, the market totally fucking crashes, and, like, Japan, like, it all goes to shit, basically. And you end up in this period of what is called the lost decade, basically, Yusunawareta Junin, which is where Japan's economy crashes and then is totally stagnant for, like, 10 years, and it's really rough. And Yakuza 1 is set and came out in 2005, which is, like, after that lost decade, but it was still, like, I mean, Japan's still feeling the effects of that crash. If anyone's hoping that, like, America's going to finally, like, magically recover from our recession, like, that's not how that works, right? Like, with, there's still that kind of sensibility and that sensation of like, oh yeah, we're going to feel the effects of that housing market crash in America for a while. And but in 2005, like, that was still pretty fresh, the bubble bursting, and you were still feeling those effects. And there's something about now Kiwami being remade and having a lot of other story elements put into it from the perspective of 2017 that's like pretty far away from that. And then also having this other story being told of the, as a prequel of who these characters were and what they were going through during the bubble economy, all of a sudden makes that story in Kiwami, I think, like, about that contrast and about that change. Because one of, and I can't believe I missed this, because I know, like, I studied as part of a literature class in school, I studied some of the literature from around that period in Japanese history. So it's like, I knew that stuff pretty well, and I'd never made the connection of that the beginning of the game, which is set in like the mid to early 90s, Kiryu takes this murder rap for his friend and goes to jail for 10 years and then comes out 10 years later into a world he doesn't recognize where all of his friends have moved on and everyone is pessimistic and cynical, and like all the side quests in the game are about people trying to just do like really cheap get rich quick schemes and trying to scam people and just like trying to steal money off the streets, and you're constantly being tried, like people are constantly trying to scam Kiryu or pulling some weird like scheme on him in all the side quests. And it just clicked into places like, oh shit, yeah, okay, that's what this story is doing. And I think especially the way the game at the end sort of deals with that and uses like actual physical money as a symbol, which is very interesting, because in Yakuza 0, money is this utterly disposable thing you never give a shit about because you have so much, you're just drowning in money, you're getting 100,000 yen every fucking second, you never think about it. And the problem in Yakuza 0 is, like, you have all this money, how do you ever spend it, and what are you going to spend it on? That's like kind of a lot of the plot of Yakuza 0. In Yakuza 1, it's just about people trying to get just raw, hard, cold fucking cash. They don't know what they're going to do with it, but it's all about like this, like there's this lost 10 billion yen, and that is a shit ton of money right now, and we need to find it. And I think that story is, that has way more thematic resonance at its end than I thought it was going to have playing through it. And again, I don't know how much of that would have been present in the original Yakuza, but I think it definitely, it makes it a game that's really worth playing if you played Yakuza 0. And I think there's a lot more to that story than I even gave it credit for while playing through it. So,
nice.
Yeah, Kiwami, awesome game. Again, definitely though, having played it, for sure play Yakuza 0 first. Like, there's a lot of that extra story context that sort of builds out that theme comes from playing Yakuza 0. So I think that is my absolute recommendation, is play 0 first and then play Kiwami.
So how many Yakuza games are going to be on your top 10 this year?
I haven't reconciled that with myself yet, how I do that placing.
Yes.
What makes for sense for those. But
if only Kiwami 2 was coming out this year.
It is in Japan, technically. Yeah. It's coming out like December 20th or something in Japan. So I could cram it the fuck in.
I want you to do that. Yeah. So you can have 3 Yakuza games on your top 10.
There we
10.
Go.
Yes.
Yeah.
No, anyway. Cool. I still look forward to playing these games at some point.
Yeah, they're really good.
All right. Let's move on to the news. And we have a boatload of news, in part because Nintendo dropped a Nintendo Direct.
Yes,
and
like a much meatier Nintendo Direct than I was expecting. I thought it was going to be one of the smaller ones they did, but
yeah,
there was a lot in there.
Yeah, I'm excited to talk about some of that. All right, so we have to start with a sad piece of news.
Oh, yeah.
Which is Harry Dean Stanton, the wonderful, beloved character actor, recently seen in Twin Peaks The Return, passed away this week at the ripe old age of 91.
Yeah.
And I didn't realize he was 91, because he's just been around forever.
Yeah.
Someone on Twitter, I forget who said it, said he was one of many actors who have passed away recently who just was like a big oak in the forest. That it felt like he'd been there forever, and he'd be there forever. And it's like, when the oak tree disappears, there's just something existential, like, how can it be gone? And I feel that way about Harry Dean Stanton. We could list great roles of his all day long.
Yeah, I mean, he's been in, like, every movie ever. If you've ever seen a movie and you look at its cast list, Harry Dean Stanton's probably on there somewhere, because it does, he just has he had an ability of just creeping up in there, even in, like, a small role or sometimes in bigger roles, but he was just in everything.
And he's always good.
Yes, he always gave it his all.
It's, and both of these guys were in Alien. He's like, yeah, John Hurt,
exactly,
in that quality of, yeah, like, if a movie had John Hurt or if a movie had Harry Dean Stanton, it was worth watching in some sense.
Uh-huh.
And both also that I can easily forget that they were both in Alien. Harry Dean, yeah, Stanton more, because, John Hurt has the more, let's say, scene-stealing scene,
yeah,
in Alien. But, you know, Harry Dean Stanton's in that movie. He's great.
Yeah, no, he's got some really good scenes.
And it's just, he's such a laid-back performer, and I mean that in the sense of that he feels like he's just part of the world, no matter what world it is. It doesn't ever look like he's acting. Obviously he is, but it's just like he's there. He's a part of it. He feels so organic to it. And easy to take for granted because of that, but in the best way.
I mean, it's that he was the perfect kind of character actor that he had, exactly what you're talking about. He had that ability to just be like, you never questioned it. You never even thought, like, you never did that second glance. The way that, like, for any leading man or, like, leading lady role in a movie, you always have this, there's a part of you that understands this person is an actor. Because it's like, you know, it's Tom Cruise. It's, you know... It's Brad Pitt. It's fucking Bryan Cranston. This is like whoever, you know, it's a big actor. You know them really well. And they can be giving the most amazing performance in the world. But still, you know that that's this actor and this is their job and they're doing this. And you respect it and you love it. And you fall into that performance. But there's always a part of you that knows that. And the greatest character actors like Harry Dean Stanton, you never even think... You never even think this. Like, that could have just been a guy that was on the set that somehow was being filmed... And he was just there, or it was just something that they filmed this whole scene, and then they were looking at the footage, and they're like, who the fuck is this? What the fuck? Where did this guy come from? And he's just there, and the whole scene is just, it's just there. He's just there. Yeah. And he, like you said, he's just a part of that world and everything he's in, and you never think about it.
You know, the Criterion Collection, as they often do when a beloved actor passes away, will share a clip or something. They were sharing stuff from Repo Man, which is one of his, obviously, most beloved roles. And one of his biggest, like, central, like, he's the main character in that. And that's one of the movies in the Criterion Collection. I would love a specific count from the people at Criterion. How many movies in their collection is he in?
Because
for the, especially the era of American cinema Criterion likes to go back to a lot, he's gotta be in, like, dozens of their movies.
Yeah.
Like, obviously, you could do a count of how many movies he's been in overall. It's just that subset. There's something about... He kind of is one of those actors who's representative of sort of an era and tenor of American cinema. And he just kind of appears all over the place. Obviously, we talked about him a lot this year because he was in Twin Peaks The Return.
Yeah.
Reprising a role no one thought would get reprised.
Yeah.
And I gotta say, I still... If you haven't seen his scene, he's only in one scene in Fire Walk With Me. It's a great fucking scene. He's hilarious in it. But then he became a much deeper, sadder, more introspective character in The Return, and he's so phenomenal in it.
Yeah.
And it just adds yet another layer of, you know, poignancy to the season of Twin Peaks that so many of the major figures in that season died shortly before it aired, or now shortly after.
Yeah.
And, I mean, that show is just... It is transience on film, and that's fascinating.
Yeah, it makes Twin Peaks The Return feel so much like an end of an era in so many ways. And it's amazing that so many of these really great performers, you know, got to have, like, this incredible role in this incredible project to sort of, like, bow out, you know?
Yeah,
and,
I mean,
and it's... Yeah.
I know they shot it, like, 2 years ago, but you would not look at him... In Twin Peaks The Return, you'd say he looks old, because he does, and that's fine. But a lot of people in The Return do. But you wouldn't say he looked like he was 2 years away from death or something. He just, he had it 100%.
Yeah.
And some beautiful scenes in that series. Like, it might have been his last scene in the series. Is it the one where the guy comes in after seeing Steven shoot himself at the tree, and he comes up to Carl? No, that's not, I'm thinking of, that's a good scene. But Carl has an earlier scene where one of his people is coming up, and Carl is telling him, stop selling your blood.
Yes, don't like it when people sell blood to eat.
Yeah.
Like, I rewatched a couple of his scenes from Twin Peaks The Return after
that was,
he passed away. That was one of the, that's one of the ones that stands out to me the most. Because that character is so, this heart of that show in a really weird way. Because, like, he's pretty ancillary to most of the other stuff going on. He kind of intersects with some of the Twin Peaks stuff more directly. But generally, he was just this, like, kindly old guy running this, you know, managing this trailer park. And was just this, like, heart and soul of that town. And was, you know, so pure in so many ways. And, yeah, that scene where he comes out and he, like, there's this nice guy living in that trailer park who's doing all these chores around that isn't getting paid. And he pays him money. Just, like, rent's due in a week. Don't pay it. Just don't pay it. And are you going to go sell blood? Stop. Like, the hospital needs blood. But you've given enough. Yeah. I don't like it when people sell blood to eat.
It's a great, it's one of, to me now, it's a recent scene, but it's like one of the defining Harry Dean Stanton scenes for me.
Yeah.
So great. Anyway.
It's also just so disconnected from everything else in that, but like it's anchored in him.
Well, because he was playing this like an observer character.
Yeah.
He wasn't part of these stories, but he lived just outside them. And of course, his intro to the new series was the scene where the kid gets hit by the car, uh-huh. and he's having this like spiritual experience with it. Oh, what an actor. What a legacy.
Yeah.
And so glad we got that last bow from him this spring and summer. So yeah. Speaking of Twin Peaks, the next piece on our outline is David Lynch via Twitter announced Twin Peaks, the third season, as it's called on the Blu-ray, is coming to Blu-ray and DVD December 5th. Has a great cover art
yeah.
with its evil coop and good coop kind of overlaid in a way that makes me look. I hope the package is like some kind of Velcro that you open and like there's something fun with
yeah.
it, because why not do something fun like that? But yeah, coming December 5th, I'm just excited we got a confirmation because I want to see this fucking thing on Blu-ray.
Yeah, definitely.
As soon as possible. The interesting thing to me is that it's called on the box Twin Peaks the third season. I've gone on my rant about why I didn't like when people were calling it the third season.
Yeah.
Now it's like the official Showtime CBS moniker. And I guess my last word on it is just that, one, seasons of TV don't air 27 years apart.
Right, yeah, that's a good point.
That's like my basic thing. Kyle MacLachlan, for the most part, wasn't playing the same character from seasons 1 and 2.
Yeah.
Mostly different creative team in a lot of ways, because this was, you know, Lynch doing every episode with his people, stuff like that. You know, very different cast and tenor and tone. And more than anything, I think if you call, and this was a part of the reaction I think on Twitter for people who didn't like it, I saw a lot, was if you thought of it as season 3, like we did 29 episodes and then the pilot of the Showtime show was episode 30, that carries such a different set of expectations.
Yeah.
And it's unfair to the show, because if you view it as this is the next episode following Cooper goes into the Red Room and comes out evil, then it's really bad if you view it that way.
Yeah.
Like, it's a terrible season 3, if that's what you want to view it as. If you view it as its own thing, which is why I prefer calling it Twin Peaks The Return, it's great, but you do have to take it on its own merits, and I just don't think it's fair to the show
yeah.
to call it the third season. So.
It's a weird, yeah, I think it just puts you in a weird, it puts it into a weird space that I don't think it belongs and shouldn't be put, and it also just makes it feel like it leaves this like wider door open for a fourth season,
yeah.
semantically speaking. That to me is like, I mean, who knows? Maybe David Lynch does want to make more Twin Peaks. He probably doesn't know right now if he does or not. But
that's
basically
what he said in the interview recently.
But yeah, I really prefer the term Twin Peaks The Return. I think that's what we're going to use on this podcast, regardless of official Blu-ray art.
It
doesn't feel right. It doesn't feel right to call it season 3 of Twin Peaks.
No, again, more than anything else, seasons of TV don't air 27 years apart.
Like, I'm way more comfortable with calling, like, the X-Files reboot stuff, like, season 10 and season 11, you know?
Yeah.
Like, because those at least, like, are carrying more of, like, the spirit in the direction of the original show. So, like, Twin Peaks The Return is so different in kind of every single metric, except for it's called Twin Peaks. It has that, like, opening theme song. It has a lot of the same returning cast that are playing mostly the same characters. But other than those things, everything about it is completely fucking different.
It's very in conversation with original Peaks, but it's not the same thing exactly, you know? So, yeah,
like if instead of it being called Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me, it was called Twin Peaks The Movie.
Yeah, that'd be a really bad way to do that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great... I want that on the Criterion release of Firewalk with Me they're doing. I want a reversible cover where it's Twin Peaks the movie, and it's like Kyle MacLachlan holding a gun in the center of it.
Yeah.
Like, just misrepresent that movie as much as you can.
Yes, yeah,
be great.
Absolutely.
Anyway, I'm just excited to get the set in, and I hope it has 18 full hours of audio commentary where David Lynch only talks about the show for about an hour.
Exactly, yes. Most of it is just talking about random other shit that's going on.
All right, let's go over to some movie news. Wonder Woman 2, which we all knew was going to get made at some point.
Oh, what? They're making a sequel to Wonder Woman.
But Patty Jenkins, director of Wonder Woman 1, the very good director of Wonder Woman 1, who made Warner Brothers a lot of money. They had been kind of in negotiations for a long time, and given how much turnover there had been at DC, I think a lot of us were worried this might not come through.
Yeah.
Luckily, Patty Jenkins was confirmed. She's going to direct Wonder Woman 2. She's going to get a shit ton of money, somewhere in the vicinity of like $9 million plus back end, which I think is awesome.
Yeah.
Because if you don't know, that's far and away the highest a woman has ever been paid to direct a movie in Hollywood, which is just cool.
Yeah.
And it's coming out December 2019, although apparently a Star Wars movie is coming out then, so someone's going to budge.
Yeah.
But we'll see. Anyway, I just think that's cool. I'm glad they got her back to direct. Wonder Woman is the best thing they have going, and they should pay whatever they have to keep that team together.
Yeah, that makes me like way more interested in Wonder Woman 2, because it was one of those weird things at because of Wonder Woman being set in World War I, makes like coming out of the end of that movie, you're like, I have no idea what Wonder Woman 2 is going to be. Kind of like with Captain America, it was like, at least you had that connection to the Avengers immediately. But yeah, having her back to direct is like, yes, I'm definitely interested in that movie.
Yeah.
Because I'm confident in her ability to, you know, explore that character.
And, you know, I think we were all right to be worried they were going to not have her back, because the way this tends to go is a woman directs a successful first entry in a franchise, and then they kick her to the curb and find a white guy.
Yes, like Twilight.
Twilight did that. I think some other recent, Fifty Shades of Grey did
yes,
that.
Yes, that's another good
one. You know, these are good movies, but like...
But it's, yeah, I mean, you know.
That's not the point.
Yes.
They still did really well, and... Yeah.
Yes. As soon as they are proved financially successful, it's like, well, thank you. Now we'll open up our closet.
Yeah.
White dudes, come out. It's your turn at the bat.
And I've seen the Twilight movies, and I can tell you right now, the problem with the first movie wasn't the direction. It was the lack of budget.
Sure, yes.
Because
yeah.
the other Twilight movies...
And arguably the source material.
Well, that too. But putting that aside, that's just taken for granted, right?
Right.
It's the other Twilight movies look nicer, not because the people directing were like some geniuses. It's because they had money.
Right.
You know, that's part of it.
Yeah.
But yes, Wonder Woman 2, I'm glad Warner Brothers seems to know they have a good thing and aren't killing that, which is nice. Speaking of which, Star Wars Episode 9, last week we reveled in the news that they kicked Colin Trevorrow to the curb because he was completely unqualified for the job. And they announced this week that they have secured J.J. Abrams to write and direct Star Wars Episode 9 for release delayed to December 2019 because no one on Earth was going to be able to get that movie made by May of 2019.
Yeah.
So I get some people were disappointed because it's kind of the boring expected choice. I also think J.J. Abrams is a good director and did a really good job on Episode 7. And I think it's totally fair to say it's nice to have the continuity within the trilogy.
Sure.
He did a great job with those actors. I'm a lot more excited about it with JJ at the helm than I was with Colin Trevorrow.
Sure, so. Yeah. I mean, as someone who didn't love Episode 7, like I don't love really any JJ Abrams movie. Probably the Star Trek one is the thing he's done I like the most. But even that, I'm not like head over heels for. I'm not super excited by him coming back. But it is something that's like it makes a lot of sense as a choice, and obviously a lot of people really loved Episode 7, so I think it's probably the right thing to do.
Yeah, because Rian Johnson, I think they wanted to get, but I don't know how he would have been able to do this back-to-back with 8. So, you know, I think it makes sense. I would like them to get outside of the directorial box a little bit with some of their other spinoffs and stuff.
Yeah.
But for now, I think this is good. And I like J.J. Abrams. He gets a lot of shit these days, I think, because it's kind of cool to show J.J. Abrams, but like... You know, I think his movies have a lot of energy. I think he's really good with actors, and he's really good at choosing actors. I like how he visually shoots movies. I love his use of light and color. So, you know, I don't think he's the greatest director ever or anything, but I think he's a good director. And,
sure,
you know, he had the tone right for Star Wars.
Yeah.
And I think that's a well-directed movie, if nothing else. So I'm looking forward to that. And, you know, to me, we dodged a bullet, and let's check what we got.
Yeah.
Because, you know... I'll just, again, the CGI in Jurassic World looked worse than it did in Jurassic Park, and it takes a special kind of incompetent to do that, and I wouldn't want that on Star Wars.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, we don't want the special kind of incompetent on Star Wars. Anyway, moving on to our next item, over to the world of games for the rest of our news section. Bruce Straley this week announced he is departing from Naughty Dog. Bruce Straley had been with Naughty Dog for a very long time and is best known as the co-director, along with Neil Druckmann, of The Last of Us and Uncharted 4.
Yeah.
Also co-writer, had been a designer at Naughty Dog forever, had worked on the Uncharted games too. By all accounts, this is not a split where everyone's mad at each other. It seems like a very, you know, friendly leaving.
Yeah, amicable.
Amicable parting and, you know, very nice letter he left about it. And he had already been on sabbatical for about a year. If you read the book Blood, Sweat, and Pixels, you learn that he went from, like, all crunch all the time on The Last of Us to Uncharted 4, which was developed pretty much entirely in 2 years, which I did not know.
Right, yeah, because that was, you know, Amy Hennig had her version of the game that, by accounts in that story, was not coming together the way that Naughty Dog wanted, and so that she left, and then they had to find new game directors. So yeah, Neil Druckmann and Bruce Straley kind of rolled immediately off of The Last of Us coming out, and were going to have a long vacation, and then they were pulled into a room, and it's like, we need people to direct Uncharted 4 for us. It's like, The Last of Us is our most successful game right now. It's like, Fuck. And so they did that, and were trying to find a way out of the project by promoting someone else up internally while they kind of like got the project back on its feet, but that didn't work out. So they kind of just directed two games back to back, which sounds like a real stressful fucking way to spend 4 years of your life.
Yes.
Four to six.
So who knows where he'll go next. Look, Bruce Straley is great at what he does. He seems like he's also a very nice guy.
Yeah.
I have not heard of anyone having bad things to say about him. Jason Schreier, author of that book, tweeted that in all his conversations with Naughty Dog, people talked about him like he was a god to them, like that they really respected the work he did. And so I'm interested to see what he does next. What he does next might be like another 6 months of vacation, which is fair.
Yes, yeah.
But
earned it.
Yeah, earned it. But yeah, I you know, and here's the thing though. Naughty Dog will be fine without him. Like, not that, I mean, they've lost a really great director and all that. I think if Uncharted: The Lost Legacy taught us anything, it's that they have a ridiculously deep bench of talent there.
Yeah.
Neil Druckmann's still there. That is Naughty Dog. You read that book, you realize also, like, they are really a team. Like, you don't want to fall into the trap of pretending like these are auteur works like we view with, like, a David Lynch project or something.
Right.
It's much more of a team effort than that, and that team remains, and that's great. But it is sad that we won't have him on a Naughty Dog game in the future.
Yeah.
So,
but, you know, he put his time in, you know.
Oh boy, absolutely.
He did his due diligence by that company for like over 20 years, I think.
And just like I am excited to see where Amy Hennig is going next. Yeah. I mean, we know she's working on that Star Wars game. I really want to see what it is.
Yeah, me too.
Yes. With Bruce Straley, I can't wait to see what he does. And, you know, Naughty Dog has still done great since Amy Hennig left. I assume they'll still do great. And Neil Druckmann is a trooper for jumping into Last of Us Part 2.
Last of Us Part 2, yeah.
Yeah. Because, I mean, apparently Naughty Dog has been able to, like, slow down, and they're in a much better flow now for production, so no one's, like, killing themselves.
Yeah.
But, yeah, Neil Druckmann will have had three in a row over there. That's just nuts.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so big gaming news. Smaller gaming news, but I think it's interesting because it kind of came out of nowhere.
Yeah.
Is that Rockstar announced that L.A. Noire, a game, they didn't develop it, right?
Just published it. Yeah. The developer is no longer with us.
Okay.
They were going to make a game called The Horror of the Orient that just came out, and that team just disappeared.
All right. Well, anyway, L.A. Noire from 2011. Your game of the year, 2011.
Yes, it's a great fucking game.
Yeah, yeah. On a very old rendition of this podcast. Is coming to PS4 and Xbox One and Nintendo Switch on November 14th.
And VR. There's a limited Vive VR version that is some of the cases are being put into a VR version of that game, which is weird to me, but sure.
So
if you can do it, I guess.
Yeah. So, we're probably never getting that Red Dead Redemption remake everyone wants.
Right, yeah.
But we're getting L.A. Noire, and I've heard it's good.
It's really good. I also think it's a game that people underestimated in some ways. Like, I still think that is a game that people, like, really dramatically underestimated and underread that game's narrative chops when it came out. It does things with perspective and, like POV in a video game in a narrative sense, not necessarily, you know, third-person, first-person sense, but, like, what kind of information is being presented to the player as opposed to what information is being privileged for the character. That game plays with that, of the character of Cole Phelps. That game plays with that dynamic a lot in a way I think is really clever and is, like, really sort of germane to the noir genre that, honestly, I think just, like, a lot of people in 2011 didn't quite catch in some ways what that game was doing with that stuff. Because games just don't play with that perspective stuff that often, narratively. So I think it's a game well worth going back to. It's not a game without flaws. It's an incredibly unique game, and being an incredibly unique game usually means you have very unique, weird issues. And so that game has some weird issues to it. But there has been no game like L.A. Noire before it. There has been no game like L.A. Noire since. So I think it is a game that is worthy of going back to, and I'm probably going to pick it up again and play it through, because I haven't played it since 2011.
Yeah, I will have no time for it this November, maybe later down the road I will get it. And the fact that it's coming out on Switch kind of guarantees that I will get it, because I'm more and more thinking the Switch might be the best console on the market right now, and it's great, and I love that they're doing that. It apparently will not have all the same visual enhancements that they're doing for PS4 and Xbox One, which makes sense, although Skyrim looks like it's got most of it, but Skyrim is probably a little simpler in some ways. But yeah, it's going to be on Switch, which is really cool, and also, we're going to have a Rockstar game on a Nintendo platform.
Right, yeah.
Can you name the last time that happened?
Grand Theft Auto Chinatown Wars?
That is correct,
There you go. You thought you were going to trip me up. Did not.
But that was a long time ago.
Yes, it was. Yeah.
I did play that. That's a good Grand Theft Auto game.
Yeah, it is.
And it was at the time, it was very surreal to have all that blood on my DS.
Yes.
But we're going to have a similar experience, I guess, now with L.A. Noire. So I think that's cool. And it's something we're going to talk about later with Nintendo. Clearly, third parties are coming to the Switch in a way they did not to the Wii U.
Yes. Yeah, and that's one way to put it.
One way to put it. And this is cool. So, hey, the more ways to play a game, the better.
Yeah.
And I like that L.A. Noire is kind of getting... revived here. I think I have it on PS3. It might have been on PS Plus.
I think it was on PS Plus.
Okay. Yeah. So that's probably where I have it from. But I my PS3 is in a closet at the moment, so I'm not going to play it that way. But this is cool that it's coming out again.
I'm really curious to see how that, like, the facial animation stuff holds up, because that was, like, the big thing in that game was they had this really intense performance capture stuff for the face and only the face, which is always one of the weird parts of that game, is, like, the body of the characters animated, like, super video game ass, like Grand Theft Auto people, but their facial animation was, like, eerily exact, because that was a whole mechanic of the game, is you had to read their expressions to figure out if they're concealing some information from you when you're interrogating them. I'm just curious to see, like, in my memory, that game still kind of has the best facial animation in any game I've played, but I'm curious to see if that still holds true, or if, like, you know, Uncharted 4 and those kinds of games have come up with, like, their versions of facial animation capture or facial motion capture that is on par with that or not.
Yeah. That was a generation ago, quite literally.
Yes, it was a long time. 6 years ago now.
It's
weird to think about.
Yeah, but that's cool. Do you think it's a little weird that this is the game Rockstar is putting out again?
It's insane. I have no idea. Like, when I saw that, I was like, is it April 1st? What the fuck? Like, why are they putting L.A. Noire out again? Like, I love that game. I know there are, like, that game has a fan community, but it didn't have, like, the most, like, amazing reception in the world when it came out. It was a pretty divisive game in 2011. And it's, like, a really weird game that also Rockstar did not develop themselves. So there's, like, all these weird reasons why you wouldn't think that L.A. Noire would be a game they'd bring back up, compared to doing, like, you know, the much-wanted PC version of Red Dead Redemption that people have wanted for years now.
Yeah.
Instead of doing that, they're doing an updated, like fancified version of L.A. Noire for modern consoles.
Because it's also, like, you know, L.A. Noire, I think, needs this rediscovery. But frankly, I think Red Dead and GTA 4 especially would really benefit from a coat of paint.
And they would probably sell really well.
That's what I was going to say.
They would probably sell a lot better than L.A. Noire.
I mean, one, like, Rockstar has the resources to put a team on one of these. Like, they have mini Scrooge McDuck vaults of money from GTA 5 and microtransactions.
I mean, they just get shipped new vaults of money from GTA 5 every month, as far as I understand.
That's how I understand. So, yeah. So they could do it with Red Dead and GTA 4. And I am a little baffled that they haven't. But whatever, I'll take it.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I'm way more interested in getting this than I would in an updated GTA 4 or Red Dead. So
I probably am too. I would love, because I think GTA 4 is a much better game than 5, and I would love
to. Yeah, I agree.
I'd love to, but it's impossible to go back and play now, because it looks wrong.
Yeah,
and all this.
Yes. It was a different time for video games. Early generation games don't age well.
Usually. I mean, it's basically a PS2 game that you play on your PS3. You know,
right,
like it doesn't feel quite like that generation of games. And I think it could benefit from, like, checkpoints in the middle of missions and things like that.
Yeah,
remember, that was not in GTA 4. But, yeah.
I want to see those high-res Ricky Gervais comedy performances you could go to in that game. That's a deep cut.
Yeah, Jesus. Anyway, but let's move on to the next thing. Before we get into the Nintendo Direct, there was an interesting piece of Nintendo news, which is Reggie Fils-Aimé, the head of Nintendo of America, gave an interview where he talked about Super NES Classic stock.
Yeah.
And he talked about how, like, this is the most emphatic Nintendo has been on saying, we're making more, we promise. He said specifically, don't buy it from scalpers, don't pay more than $80, it'll be out there, we promise, we're gonna do it. And, you know, I'm not gonna say I believe that 100%,
sure, yeah.
But I will say, like, that would be kind of astonishing if Reggie put his reputation on the line and just lied through his teeth about that.
Right.
And it does seem like, you know, pre-orders have not been getting canceled en masse. Walmart did cancel, like, duplicates. Like, if you ordered two, which I think is fair. But, like, overall, like, everything seems to be going rather smoothly. We've seen what some of the stock numbers are going to be at stores, and they do seem higher than the NES Classic. So, fingers crossed. Generally, I like Reggie, and I want to trust the guy. But, you know, he did kind of put words on paper there.
Yeah.
So, but then this was followed up by something that seemed like they're making good on that word, which is that Nintendo did officially do a press release announcing that not only will they have the SNES Classic throughout this year and next year, they'd previously said just through this year, so they're going to keep making it. The NES Classic will go back into production and will be available sometime in 2018, near the summer, I think is what they said. So they have listened to us. It was a little late to listen to us.
Yes, sanity has fallen upon Nintendo. They're like, wait, this thing sold like fucking hotcakes. Should we make more of them? No. Wait. Yes, we should!
Over the last year, someone at Nintendo was going to night school and learning about supply and demand, and it finally,
like, oh, I've had this graph the wrong way the whole time. Oh my god, this is so embarrassing.
But, you know, I wanted to get your reaction. So, Sean, the SNES Classic, they are committed as a company to getting these to people who want them. The NES Classic will be back, so we can all get one if we want it. What do you think about that?
It sounds like they have finally decided that this, their classic version console thing is successful enough that they're just making it a normal fucking product.
Yes.
Which is like, it took them long enough to get there, but it is the right place for them to go to. Yes. It was like, it was something where a lot of their verbiage around it had been like straddling this weird line between a normal fucking product and a limited edition product, which are two very different things. And I think that's what caused a lot of the confusion in the marketplace. And I wish that they had had this messaging out there for when the NES Classic was originally selling, and so people didn't have to fucking, like, you know, sell their kidney to finally get one from their fucking doctor or something, you know? Like, if there was some sanity in the system at some point along the way, that would have been nice. But they got there, you know, and you have to give them credit for that.
And between the Reggie interview and that press release, like, there's now also transparency. Like, they're not saying, we're going to have the NES Classic this Christmas. It's, we need time to get factories next summer, you know? Like, so it all seems sane. It seems good. It feels like all the good stuff from the Switch and the 3DS is, like, maybe radiating outward a little bit to the rest of the company. And that's a nice thing. Because, you know, we're going to talk about this Nintendo Direct, and it's nothing but cool stuff. I mean, they've got a lot of good stuff in the work. But this was, like, this weird black mark, and it does feel like some sanity has reigned. And, you know, now I feel like now might be the time to start doing the, like, speculation of what the next classic system is.
Sure.
Because now it feels like something that could actually happen and that we could all go buy if we wanted.
Yes, the Virtual Boy Classic.
Yes.
I mean, VR is so huge. They're going back to it.
It literally has all the games from the Virtual Boy.
Or it's the Donkey Kong Classic, and they're just selling Donkey Kong arcade cabinets. And it just has Donkey Kong, and they're just vintage cabinets, and they're like $2,000.
And that's the one thing they mass produce.
Exactly. And yes, yes.
And then they go bankrupt for it.
It's like, no, this isn't a limited edition item. We're making, like, millions of them. You're making millions? We're making millions of them. We're very confident in this product.
Well, speaking of confidence, let's talk about the Nintendo Direct from September 13th. So I watched this live. Did you get a chance to see this show?
No, I watched it. I watched a lot of the trailers after the fact on the Japanese Nintendo YouTube channel, which I'm already subscribed to.
Okay, cool. Yeah. Yes. Yoshiaki Koizumi hosted this.
Yes.
And it is a side note. Like, what he's up there for right now is he's the producer on the Mario line, so he's the producer of Mario Odyssey.
Which means he also has to come out in Mario costume every time now.
Yes, which is great. I was looking up this dude's biography. I didn't realize how far back Yoshiaki Koizumi works. Like, if you love a Nintendo game, he probably worked on it in, like, a really central capacity. He was there with, like, Miyamoto and everyone on all of the early Mario and Zelda games. And recently he's, like, he hasn't worked on Zelda in a while because he's been shepherding Mario. But I just thought that was interesting. Like, I had not really realized how central this guy has been to Nintendo from the NES days.
Yeah.
Which is crazy. But anyway, it was cool to have him host. I like when they bring, like, their developers up and do that. But they started with a spotlight on Pokemon Ultra Sun and Ultra Moon, which I really have no interest in, but I did like that they showed some off because all we really knew about this game was that it was coming out.
Yeah, it was something that I had forgotten that was a real thing. Like, I had forgotten that that was actually announced and wasn't a rumor anymore.
I think it got overshadowed by the Metroid, you know, 3DS thing.
Yes,
that no one's starving for Pokemon.
No, There's some might say there's too much Pokemon right now.
Yeah, but I will say, even though I did play, I didn't beat Pokemon Sun, but I played like 15 hours of it, so I know what the game is. This trailer was utter gibberish to me.
Okay.
And I'm going to go through my notes and we're going to try to make sense.
Because I did not watch this trailer because I wasn't that interested in it.
It was like a 4-minute spotlight, but like I understood none of it. So Pikachu has a hat and there are some other Pikachus. So there was that. I got that. I think there's a new legendary. And then there were four pieces of new news. News one was Necrozma, who is a new legendary. I think that's what that was, but I don't know. I don't know what Necrozma is. Point two is you can now chart new areas of Alola, so there's new areas they've added, like a Valley of Pikachus, a new beach, and there's new character customization, so that's cool. 3 was just called bonuses, and the bonuses was, like, if you buy the game by January 10th, you get a special Rockruff, which I think is a Pokemon from Pokemon Sun and Moon, and you also get 12 Quick Balls. And if you buy Pokemon Gold and Silver, which is coming to the Virtual Console on September 22nd, you will get Celebi in all versions of Sun and Moon, including the originals. So that's nice. Celebi, I will say, was much harder to get the first time around. I had to get a special GameCube disc from a pre-order of Pokemon Colosseum, so you kids have it easy.
Sure. Yeah. Anyway. Celebi, not a Pokemon I care for.
No. And then number 4 was, this was the most confusing, Unknown Ultra Bursts, UB Burst, and UB Assembly. And I don't really know what that means or what
that
they do.
That makes perfect sense. No, yeah, like unlimited...
So yeah.
Assemblies.
The kids love it. That's all I can say.
It's the Pokemon.
Look, it's Pokemon. It's probably going to be a decent game, and it's going to sell like hotcakes.
I mean, it's the ultimate Pokemon.
Yes.
At this point.
Ultra Sun and Moon. So yes, that's coming out. Let's see. They also announced they're going to have a new 2DS XL that is Pokemon themed. Japan's getting more of them, but they all look kind of cool. Although playing Metroid Samus Returns reminds me, get a 3DS. You don't. There's a lot of games that need the 3D, and the 2DSs look cool. I know, but to get a 3DS. They're cool. Then they had their first batch of what they called headlines, which was a rapid fire string of news and little trailers.
Right.
So I'll just go through some of these. Let's see. They had a quick little reminder of the Mario & Luigi Superstar Saga remake that's coming out.
Right.
Looks good. I'm excited. It's coming out on my birthday, so I'm excited. Kirby Battle Royale is coming to 3DS in January. That's the last of the mini games from Kirby Planet Robobot that they've taken and made like standalone games that you can buy for like $5 in the eShop.
Yeah.
Which is kind of neat. I'd recommend just buying Kirby Planet Robobot because it's great. They also have a poll on the web for Kirby's 25th anniversary to decide the best Kirby moves. So you can go vote on that. If
like attacks?
Like when he sucks people in and like gets their hats and
yeah,
stuff.
Okay. But you said moves. I thought like, I like it when he jumps. I like it when he runs to the left. I like it when he runs to the right.
Yeah. No, I mean like his like sucking in okay, like absorption yeah. thing. Yeah. Let's see.
It's the Darth Maul lightsaber from Kirby 64.
Yeah. Something about Yo-Kai Watch 2. I don't know what Yo-Kai Watch is. There's apparently like 7 different versions of Yo-Kai Watch 2. I don't know what this is.
I saw a video on YouTube it's the Yo-Kai Watch what is it called? Like it's basically like the Yo-Kai Watch exercise that I think it's some video for like a music video and there are people dancing, but it was like 3DS character models. It was very funny. It was cute.
Nice.
There was a whole part that was about, there was a lyric about poop.
Yeah.
I thought it was very funny.
There's a new Professor Layton game with Professor Layton's daughter that's coming to 3DS October 6th. It looked good. I've never played Professor Layton, but I've heard they're good. And it had anime cutscenes that looked really nice. This was kind of a surprise, even though maybe it shouldn't have been. Minecraft is coming to new Nintendo 3DS, and actually now that's in the past tense because it was one of those wow, it's out today moments. So you can get Minecraft. It's only on the new 3DS and 2DS.
Okay.
So not the regular 3DS, 2DS. But basically that was half, oh right, Minecraft hadn't been on 3DS yet.
Yeah.
And half like, that'll probably sell really well.
Yeah, but that was definitely one of those that I had just assumed that, I assumed it was on every platform that could feasibly have it.
Well, maybe it's only on the new 3DS, so I guess the original 3DS couldn't feasibly do Minecraft, which is weird, but okay.
There you go.
Here's a cool announcement. This was a brand new announcement. They're doing a new Mario Party game for 3DS on November 10th that's called Mario Party The Top 100. Now, as they pitched it in their little trailer, they basically have taken the best 100 minigames from across the first 10 Mario Parties, and they've put them all in a package, and you can play them on 3DS. It's got download play, so you only need one cart to play with your friends and stuff. All neat. I love Mario Party. I've played up through like 7. I know all of those really well. And through 8. And so I recognized like every mini game there, and I thought it was really cool.
Is there just like a 10 of the you're on a rolling ball and push people off of the thing ones?
Like, it's really only one minigame, but yes.
But they're in like a bunch of the Mario Parties. There's a couple of those minigames that they just put in like all of them.
Yeah, Bumper Balls.
Yeah.
Yeah, Bumper Balls was in there. And I wonder if they'll have the other maps for Bumper Balls that were in Mario Party 2, because there was 3 locations you could do Bumper Balls on. But anyway.
The Jump Rope one.
Yes, the Jump Rope one was in there, I think. So some fan put a chart together of all the minigames they saw in the trailers and like matched them to the Mario Party game. Mario Party 10 had the least, as you might expect, because no one played that game. And I think maybe, who knows, that game might not even have been finished and no one knew because no one played it. Anyway, so it looks cool. Like, if it was just the mini games, I'd still be into that. It seems neat. But it might also have a full Mario Party board game because the website for the game does mention boards.
Okay.
But they didn't show that in the trailer. Yeah. So it would be really neat if this was like a, like they also took like the 10 best boards and had, like, an Ultimate Mario Party thing, that would be really neat.
Yeah, that I would be a lot more interested in that, because there's something about, like, to me, Mario Party is just a board game where you fuck everybody over because complete random horseshit happens, and it's just, like, utter nonsense, and then every once in a while you play, hopefully, a half-decent minigame, because, like, let's face it, most of those minigames were not that good. Like, but some of them were fine, a lot of them were not very good.
There's enough that I like, and my brother and I do sometimes just play some minigames on, like, our old N64, that I am interested in this either way, but I do hope it has a full Mario Party mode, and it's not the stupid car thing from 9 and 10 that no one on Earth likes.
Yeah, I want Mario Party where you can just roll the dice and land on a block that just randomly gives you a fucking star for no reason. Like, that's, I just want 100% utter horse shit, or I'm not interested.
Yep. All right, next they had a brief reminder that Metroid comes out this week. Go Metroid. And then Atlus showed off all their 3DS RPGs coming out, and there's a lot of cool stuff. There's a game called The Alliance Alive, which I don't think we'd heard about before, but it looks very cool. Shin Megami Tensei Strange Journey Redux, which is a remake of a DS game. Radiant Historia Perfect Chronology, which is a remake of Radiant Historia, which is one of the most, like, cult classic acclaimed DS games. I've never played it. They are redoing it for 3DS, which is awesome, and it's going to have a cool day one edition. So I did pre-order that because I want to make myself play that game, because I've always heard it's, like, an amazing RPG. So that's coming out. And then they also had a little look at Etrian Odyssey 5, Beyond the Myth, which is coming out in the Eye of the Storm on October 17th. So I'm not going to have time for it, but it looked very neat. They did also launch a demo that day, and I have played the about 30 minutes of the demo, and looked cool. The best thing about it, though, is the music in Etrian Odyssey 5 is fucking amazing, and like most of it is jazz saxophone.
Awesome.
So I really want to play this game. Sadly, it's coming out in the dead of the middle of October, which means there's too many other things coming out. So they had a brief reminder about Apollo Justice Ace Attorney and Fire Emblem Warriors, just to remind you those are also coming to the 3DS, and they had a new Orange 2DS XL. So that's all their 3DS news. Then they
people
had
people who keep on thinking that Nintendo's just going to abandon the 3DS. They're not there,
and they shouldn't. I think Metroid Samus Returns, which I will talk about later, is proof that that system has a whole lot of juice left in it. But yes, then they had a spotlight on Xenoblade Chronicles 2, which I always forget is still coming out this year.
Right.
Because they've got so many other games for the Switch, you'd think they'd hold something back, but they're
not. That was one that, like, I think everyone just kept on assuming that it's just going to get delayed, but the closer we get to it, it seems like, well, maybe it is.
No,
it's actually going to come out?
We did get the date. It's December 1st. It's getting a wild special edition. Like, if you like Xenoblade Chronicles, you're getting a really cool special edition. It's got a 220-page art book, a CD, all this stuff. The spotlight itself, I know nothing about Xenoblade Chronicles. It went on for like 7 minutes. It felt like longer. Everyone had a very weird British accent, because that's what they do in the dub of Xenoblade Chronicles. It looked like the art style looked really cool. It looked visually like really nice, like a very beautiful big Switch RPG. And I assume if you like Xenoblade Chronicles, this was exciting. I think for the rest of us, it was kind of like the most dead part of the Nintendo Direct, just because it kind of went on forever. But Xenoblade Chronicles 2. There's something for everyone.
Sure, yeah.
And I think, from what I can gather also, this is kind of like in the Final Fantasy, Dragon Quest tradition. This is 2 in the sense that this is a new story.
Yeah.
This isn't Shulk and all those characters. So if you haven't, like, I might at some point try to play this, because I wouldn't have to go back and play. There was Xenoblade Chronicles, and then there was Xenoblade Chronicles X for the Wii U, which was like the sequel to...
Yeah.
Anyway, so there's a bunch of these. But
I do like that they have carried on the weird tradition of doing the like UK-style localization, because I'm pretty sure the reason why that happened was that they did a like Western Europe, UK kind of like localization for Xenoblade Chronicles, and it was not originally going to come out in America, and then they're just like, we'll just like take some U's off of words and then just put this localization out in America, because it's fine, and so you just got like a bunch of British accented people and like Scottish people. It's like, oh, that's actually cool.
It's
nice to not have just everyone have American accents.
Yeah, no, it's fine. So let's see. Then they had Headlines Part 2, which was for the Switch. And this is where stuff started getting crazy. Not right off the bat, but we're going to get to something you're going to love, Sean.
Yeah.
Splatoon 2 is getting new maps, which I think are already out, because they said they were coming September 15th. I have not gone back in to check, because Destiny and Metroid and all that, and some new weapons, so that's neat. Then here's the most important news of the conference, Sean. Uh-huh. Fire Emblem Warriors got a little spotlight, uh-huh. and they announced another new character. Lindis from Fire Emblem GBA is in the game.
Did they announce that they're taking all the other characters out, because who gives a shit because Lindis is in the game?
My note is just Lin from Fire Emblem, lol Sean.
Yes.
And I tweeted you.
Now they just need to put Juge Liang from Romance of the Three Kingdoms in the game, and then my fanfiction can be complete.
Nice. But you know, you said you needed Lindis in this.
Yes, for me to consider it at all. Like, the game doesn't matter to me if she's not in there. Now, like, if I ever get a Switch or a 3DS.
It's on your radar.
I'm looking at this.
Awesome. All right.
Yeah.
Well, I assume you will be buying a Switch on October 20th to play this.
Absolutely, because there's nothing else I could possibly be spending my money and doing my time with right before the death of video games when every video game comes out.
Anyway, I'm going to try to squeeze it in. And them having Lindis
in... That's madness. You can't... This 20th. That's a week before Mario if you have a Switch. It's madness, Jonathan.
It's got a cool special edition. I'm a sucker.
You can play it whenever.
I know, but it's Fire Emblem, Sean. Mm. Kind of.
Mostly.
Mostly, it's kind of Fire Emblem. All right, Snipperclips is getting new stuff. You can now buy the game as Snipperclips Plus with 30 new stages, so like they've doubled the size of the game.
Cool.
And then that'll also be DLC. I'm glad they're supporting Snipperclips. Yeah, that is a cool game. There's a new MOBA kind of thing called Morphe's Law coming out. I wrote...
Oh, yeah.
It looks like Overwatch meets like Mexican Day of the Dead. Very weird. It launches on Switch first this winter. They were doing like their Xbox language, like Switch console launch exclusive.
Yeah. Launch exclusive.
But I mean, how crazy is it that the Switch just came out and we're getting some of that language already? But yeah, so that'll be on other stuff eventually. Rocket League, that's coming to Switch later. Still have no date.
That was one that I had just thought for whatever reason that Rocket League was already out on Switch, but
they announced it at E3.
Yeah. Maybe that's why I thought it was out.
Yeah, they showed off that they're going to have Mario and Luigi cars, because why would you not do that? Arena of Valor is a new MOBA for Switch coming this... there's a beta for free this winter. Looked like a MOBA. I don't really know what to do with that, but it's coming.
Yeah, it's kind of surprising to me that the MOBA thing has not died down a little bit to just going back to look, the only ones that are successful are Dota and League of Legends, and then kind of Smite.
Yeah.
And that's it. If you think that's where your fucking gold rush is, it's probably not.
Yeah, but anyway, so that happened. Then we had some Bethesda stuff, because we still had not had a date for Skyrim on Switch. We finally got it. It's November 17th. I like that date. That's far enough out from everything else that I can happily go back into Skyrim.
Sure.
Because I really do want to play it on Switch and dive into the game again, and I'm very excited for it. By all accounts, it looks like a really good version of the game. So that's a nice date. I was really worried they were going to put it on October 27th with everything else, and it's not.
Just to fuck you over. Just to be hey, guys, fuck you.
Yeah, but no, they did not.
You wanted to play Skyrim on your Switch? Well, you'll have to wait 2 years now. It's coming out on October 27th.
No, and then they also announced, in by far the biggest surprise, Doom 2016.
Yes.
Doom. And Wolfenstein 2, not yet out, are both coming to Switch.
Not Wolfenstein the New Order, but the sequel to Wolfenstein the New Order.
Wolfenstein 2. Doom will be later this year. Wolfenstein 2 will be early next year, so it's not launching day and date with the other versions, but it is coming. I never thought that would happen.
Yeah, that's a crazy announcement to me. I mean, it makes more sense when you think about that Bethesda is already putting stuff out on the Switch. It makes more sense to me. But, it's still, fuck, that's really... Particularly for Doom, the idea that they go back and try to find a way to, pare that down to be able to run on the Switch. This is weird.
Yeah.
It's cool, but it's weird.
And, it didn't look bad in, the footage they showed. So, I don't need another version of Doom. The PS4 version runs great and wonderful, and I don't think that's a game I'd really play on the go all that much.
Yeah, it does seem like that's a pretty intense first-person shooter. It's maybe not the best thing to play on the bus.
But that's kind of beside the point at some point, because clearly the Switch is reaching an audience of people who have not... who don't have those other consoles.
Right.
And this is just smart business if they can get these games on there in a good form. And it makes me excited for other Bethesda games. It would be awesome if they could get Fallout 4 on this.
Right, yeah.
And if they can do Doom and Wolfenstein 2 and Skyrim, that's probably doable,
Sure, yeah.
And that'd be a great way to play Fallout 4, which I've never touched. So that would be wonderful. So that's just neat stuff. And I mean, I can speak to that with, people buying the Switch for the first time. I know at least two people, directly, who they had not bought a console since... maybe the Wii or the 360, certainly right. not this generation, who saw Zelda, saw the Switch, and they got that and loved it. And clearly, I think that's going to be a large part of the Switch audience.
I know you can be like, you want to fuck some demons up?
Yeah.
You want to fucking get into this shit? Because Doom's really good.
Yes. So, hey, the more Doom, the better. And the Wolfenstein 2, in some ways, is even crazier because it's not even out yet.
But at least it's like a new game, so it's like it makes sense to that. Like, there's a tradition of porting games to that kind of console. Like, Doom, going back to Doom was one that just sort of surprised me.
I remember seeing a Reddit conversation a few months ago of people saying, you know, it looks like Skyrim on Switch is running really well. It's pretty much the special edition.
Yeah.
It looks nice. And they were asking, like, do you think Elder Scrolls 6 will launch on that whenever that comes down the pike? And a lot of people were like, that'll never happen. It'll be too new. It just, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, maybe not, but that could totally happen now. Like,
I think what's more likely is that Elder Scrolls 6 is just going to miss this generation completely.
Yes.
And, like, the Switch will be an old console by the time it comes out. And that will be the reason it's not on the Switch.
Yes, but if it were to come out, let's say, in 2020,
you know,
which isn't going to happen, but if it were. No, it's an interesting conversation to have. Then they had something about a puzzle game called Flip Wars. I don't remember. My only note was, So, I had some reaction.
Yes.
But something, Flip Wars. Then this was really interesting. They're going to start... We're not getting Virtual Console on Switch, but we are getting the Arcade Archives. And they didn't actually do a great job communicating this, but this is really neat. These are the arcade versions of a lot of Nintendo classics, which are very different than, you know, possible NES ports and stuff.
Right, yeah, because arcade machines in the 8-bit days, as far as 8-bit for consoles, the arcade versions of those games were much better.
Yeah.
Right, because that hardware is a lot more advanced.
So we're getting the original arcade version of Mario Bros. Not Super, but Mario Bros.
Yeah.
Which actually, it's kind of interesting they're starting with that one, because that's the closest to its NES counterpart, but we're doing that. Versus Super Mario Bros., which has never come out in any other form.
Yeah.
And it's basically like, it's Super Mario Bros., plus a lot of the stuff in that became what we know now as the Lost Levels, so it's a very different version of Mario Bros., of Super Mario Bros. We're getting Versus Balloon Fight, Versus Ice Climber, etc. The first one's coming out November 27th, that's Mario Bros. That's awesome.
Yeah.
That those are coming out from hiding, basically, for a long time.
Yeah. It's kind of weird that, like, that's where they're going first, but it's cool that they're going there at all.
Yes, that's my reaction exactly, because I would love to play... I actually just played Super Mario Bros., the original version, again, like, for the second time this year, because I play that game every few months, and I would love to play Versus Mario, Super Mario Bros., because that sounds like a cool way to experience, like, a really familiar game.
Right.
Like, what was it like in the arcade? That's nuts. They also showed off the Zelda Champion Amiibos. They've got those four champions from Breath of the Wild. Those are coming out November 10th. They give you special headgear based on the divine beasts in the games. That's cool. Although I did see the price later on because they were up for pre-order. The pack of all four of those is $65.
Yeah.
Which is ridiculous. And I kind of like Amiibo once in a while. But
those are never going to be applied to any other game because they're way too specific characters for Breath of the Wild. It's not like when you buy a Link one that's like, this will probably be used in another game at some point. It's fucking Link. It's like they're not going to fucking pull like... Bird dude from Breath of the Wild is not going to come up, I think, in another game.
You know, they say he's not going to be added to Smash Bros.
Probably not. I don't think, like, they have to go dig deep for Smash Bros. Characters these days. I don't think they're going to have to dig that deep.
No. All right, then they showed off some sports. We're getting NBA 2K18, WWE 2K18, FIFA 18, Pokémon Tournament DX. That's how you know a console is healthy, is when you get all the sports titles.
Yeah. Not Madden yet, but not someday. Madden.
All right, then we got a Square Enix RPG spotlight.
Sure, yeah.
And this is, we'd heard about it before, Project Octopath Traveler.
But they're still sticking with that name so far.
That better be the fucking title.
God damn it. But this presentation now puts into perspective why it is called. I mean, the name makes perfect sense. Of course, it has to be called Octopath Traveler.
Yes, this is from the team that did Bravely Default. And I could not be more excited. It looks like how I wrote it, and they call it HD 2D, but it looked like, the best way to describe it is like a 3D Super NES game. Like pixel, not like Star Fox, but like take the pixel art of like Chrono Trigger or something and make it into like a 3D world, almost like Paper Mario in some way.
It looked to me like, it's like if you made a diorama of a 16-bit RPG.
Yes, and it looks so good.
Yeah.
And, like, I mean, visually looks good, but also gameplay-wise, oh my god, I need this game. You have 8 lands, 8 stories, branching paths. Basically, you pick a different protagonist, and they all have a story that I assume intersect. They showed off 2 characters, Ulbrich the Warrior and the Dancer Primrose. and their different abilities. And then they announced a demo in the eShop today, releasing 2018 worldwide. I have the demo. There's been a lot else going on. I have only played about 10 minutes of it, so I don't have any thoughts on that yet, but I do look forward to diving into that demo a little bit. Y'all know how much I love Bravely Default. This looks really cool. Yeah. I love that the Switch is already getting something like this.
Yeah, it's the, my favorite part about it was that each of the different eight heroes, and like I said, they only showed two of them, but each of them are going to have like a different ability you can use in the like field in the open world. And the like knight dude was he can basically just challenge random people to fucking duels. And then the lady Primrose, she can like seduce people to like join her. And yeah. And so there was a shot that was just like a villager from a town was just like jumped into a battle and healed you. And I thought like, that's really fucking cool. Like that's weird and crazy, but that's a really cool idea. I just want to like grab some random person from some random village and just drag him halfway around the world with me and throw him in front of a dragon and watch him burn.
And, you know, as someone who loved Bravely Default, although I was not really into the sequel, Bravely Second, this looks like the right way to follow up Bravely Default, which is instead of just kind of doing a really good version of an old-fashioned JRPG, it's kind of like taking it to a different level and doing a different thing with it. This looks very creative and good and fun. And, again, 2018 is going to be the year of the JRPG.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of them.
And I think, again, it speaks to the health of the Switch that we're getting one of these already, and that team has moved on from 3DS to Switch, but the 3DS is still clearly very well supported. There's good stuff going on. Headlines number three they had. Update to the game ARMS. Dragon Quest Builders is coming to Switch, spring 2018. I think that was a foregone conclusion because the sequel will be coming out on that, but that's neat. Maybe I'll finally play some of that game. Then they showed off Kirby for Nintendo Switch, which at E3 was just called Kirby.
Right.
It now has a title. It's Kirby Star Allies. So luckily they're not just releasing a game called Kirby to confuse us all. But it looks very co-op focused, team-up attacks, team copy abilities. I thought it looked like a lot of fun. Very much looks like Kirby's moment in the sun, like you know, new Super Mario Bros. Has had, or the recent Yoshi games, like Yoshi's Woolly World, where we're going to have a fun like couch co-op Kirby side-scroller. Looked very good.
Yeah.
So we have that. They showed off a bunch of indies, SteamWorld Dig 2, Golf Story, Nine Parchments, Battle Chef Brigade, Tiny Metal, Super Meat Boy Forever, etc. Lost Sphere, they reminded us about. That's the new game from the Tokyo RPG Factory coming in January. Looks great. Sonic Forces coming out November 7th. Resident Evil Revelations 1 and 2 are coming out this November. And L.A. Noire on November 14th got a little moment in the sun.
Such a weird... That's so weird when you put it in with everything else.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, and a re-release of L.A. Noire. Like, fucking what?
It's a portable game now,
like,
Sean.
We shouldn't have talked about it earlier in the podcast and, like, waited until we got there to just talk about it. Yes. It's just how weird it is.
Then they ended with a spotlight on Super Mario Odyssey.
Yep.
Mario is not happy about Bowser trying to marry Peach. Cappy wants to rescue his sister Tiara, which is Peach's hat. That was a huge revelation.
Oh, yeah.
Showed off some new abilities. We have new kingdoms such as Shiveria, the Snow Kingdom, and the Sea Kingdom Bubble Lane. There's even more kingdoms they haven't showed off. They were stressing that. They showed how you use the power moons to power your ship to get from kingdom to kingdom.
It's a lot of stuff that if you paid attention to the like reporting out of E3, like a lot of that information was in those demos that, that the journalists played. But this is like the first, I think, like from Nintendo public facing talking about power moons and that stuff.
Yeah, and then the really cool new stuff was there's a character in the game. They showed off some new characters. One of them is called Uncle Amiibo, and that's how you use Amiibos.
Yeah, and because I was watching the Japanese trailer, and he's Amiibo Oji-san.
That's
which
awesome.
Is very funny.
Yes.
It's very good. Because also, it's like Amiibo, like the Amiibo logo. So it's like English text, all like small lowercase letters, and then it's just like Japanese next to it, so it stands out really well in Japanese. It's fucking hilarious.
And I am getting my Bowser Wedding Suit Amiibo along with the game. I've got that pre-ordered because why would you not?
Yeah.
And so I'm excited to meet Uncle Amiibo. There are mini games throughout the world. They showed some of those off that looked neat. And then they also, so here's where the game just, it just broke the internet, is that there's a store you can go to called Crazy Cap that but you can use your coins and get clothes and customization things. And they show off a bunch of Mario's costumes, one of which is Mario just in swim trunks, and the internet went wild for Mario's...
And you find out that Mario has the body of a toddler. That is a, that is a hairless... That is, he's a like small, compact, utterly hairless man, other than his mustache and his head of hair. But his body, that dude fucking waxes like crazy. It's disturbing.
Maybe that's a minigame. Is Get Mario Waxed?
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, it set the internet on fire. It was very disturbing to see on Twitter when I was not able to watch the Nintendo Direct live, and I was just looked at Twitter, was like, "What the fuck is happening? What did you do? Why is everyone talking about Mario's nipples? What happened? What did you do, Nintendo? What did you do?"
If you pulled those swim trunks down, I bet his penis would look like in Dragon Ball when they draw Goku's dick. It's just that little, like
a little, little bump.
Yeah, that's probably what we'd get.
It's disturbing. You're not supposed to see Mario that way. It's like his bodily proportions registered very differently to me when he doesn't have a shirt on. Like, there's something weird that, like, it highlights just how squat he is to me in a way that's very unsettling.
But what if they had gone in the other direction and he had, like, a full Italian, like, you know,
just chest like a hair. Rug. Yeah, just a rug on his chest. Like, really thick chest hair. Which, to me, in my head, that is what Mario would look like if you took his shirt off. I mean, it makes sense that that's not what they did, but it doesn't work for me. It's just this, like, impossible catch-22 that leads you to the conclusion, don't take fucking Mario's shirt off. He should have had, like, an old-school, you know, like red and white striped, full one-piece bathing suit instead of having just the trunks.
I bet that's in the game, too.
Hopefully, because I think you should be able to, you know, player choice is very important to me, and I think forcing players into, if they want a swimsuited Mario, that he has to just go trunks, I think that goes against my philosophy in playing video games.
It's insane, man. There is also the last thing they showed off. There is a Naughty Dog style photo mode in this game.
Yeah, because it was in that section that they showed it off. Because it's just because you don't see him in motion. It's just this fucking image, which is like that image you've seen all over Twitter. Because they were showing it off in the slideshow of the photo mode.
It's so good, Sean.
Yeah,
Mario Odyssey looks unbelievably good.
Yeah, it just looks utterly unhinged in kind of every way.
At this point, my top 10 list is going to be really hard to whittle down. I do know at the moment what the top two games are. Choosing between them is going to be very tough. Part of me is hoping Mario Odyssey comes in and just makes that choice for me. And if any game the rest of this year could do it for me, it would be Mario Odyssey.
Sure, yeah.
Because, again, Mario nipples.
Yes, Mario nipples. And that hat has a fucking sister. It's a family. It's a family of hats, and the sister is a tiara. I don't know how that works. I mean, I'm not, you know, an expert of, like, hat genetics, but...
Well, anyway, so that was the Nintendo Direct. They didn't announce anything, like, earth-shattering. Like, we're not getting a Smash Brothers Switch port, which at this point, my guess is they're just moving on to Smash 5.
Yeah, it would have come out by this point if they're doing it.
Or at least been announced.
Yeah.
So, yeah, so that, you know, and no virtual console, but lol, that wasn't going to happen.
Yeah, I mean, you kind of got it.
I kind of did.
The arcade thing is sort of virtual console. It's virtual arcade.
Look, we're getting that. The SNES Classic is going to be in production. We're going to get the NES Classic. I can live with it for now.
Sure.
Eventually, maybe we get all this together, but for now, I'm good. But overall, like, look, this was the presentation of a company that is in a really healthy place, and it's amazing how much the Switch has turned things around in 6 months. I mean, it's nuts.
Yeah. The thing because I think for me the most surprising thing was seeing just how much Bethesda's getting behind it, and it sort of, like, highlights for me when are EA and Activision going to come in, because those are the two big companies, like, big Western third-party companies that have not gotten involved at all.
Yeah.
You know, Ubisoft has their Rabbids and stuff. We have all the 2K sports games, but we don't have Madden. You know, we don't have Destiny or something, you know. I'm curious to see... Or, like, we don't even, like, Call of Duty this year is not announced for the Switch. I'm curious to see if that changes, because Activision put Call of Duty games out on Nintendo consoles for a long time. Like, Black Ops 2 was on the Wii U, you know, so...
Well, and all of the Modern Warfare trilogy is on Wii. You can play it with your Wiimote and Nunchuck if you want.
Yeah, if you're a weirdo.
Yes.
You know, there's one kid that was just like, everyone's making fun of me because, like, that was the thing, is I played the fucking Wii version of Call of Duty, everyone else was playing on the Xbox 360, and I'm sitting in my room with 480p fucking Call of Duty 4.
But luckily the Switch is a more modern console.
Yeah.
But no, I mean, the Switch has had, I think, pretty inarguably one of the great first years of any console. If you look at just the fucking lineup of games, it's amazing. And it seems like it's going to be very well supported. The 3DS is in a great place. All of it it's cool.
Lindis into Fire Emblem Warriors, so they're making a lot of really good choices.
I like when Nintendo is at the top of their game, because I've been with them when they're near the bottom of it.
Sure, yes.
Okay? And I'm now there, they're happy. Good point. We're all good.
Yeah.
It's great. Let's move on to talk about some games, Sean. I'm going to do a brief review of Metroid Samus Returns.
Okay.
And then we're going to talk about Destiny 2.
All right.
Okay, so let's start with Metroid.
All right.
Sean, I am so happy.
All right.
There's a new Metroid game. It's really good. like all is well. I mean, not really. Donald Trump is president. There's a lot of fucked up shit.
Yeah, like DACA got, you know, is in danger in between these podcasts.
Yeah, there's a lot of bad shit going on in the world, but it's been 7 years. We got a new Metroid game, and it's fucking great. So Samus Returns. This is ostensibly a remake of Metroid 2 Return of Samus from the original Game Boy.
Yeah.
But very much like Fire Emblem Echoes earlier this year, which was ostensibly a remake of Fire Emblem Gaiden from the Famicom, calling it a remake is kind of selling it short.
Sure.
Let me give you one idea. So if you know the length of typical 2D Metroid games, they're like 5 to 10 hours max.
Right.
Zero Mission and Fusion are both 5 hours, kind of as almost hard cap. Super Metroid can go up to 10 probably on a first playthrough, but it can be done in a lot less. I have clocked in on my play clock, not my play clock, but on my activity log on the 3DS, at least 11 hours was the last time I checked. And I still, you have 40 Metroids you have to kill, I still have 12.
Jeez.
This game is way longer than all the other Metroid games. And I have not ever played Metroid 2 on the Game Boy, like, to completion, because it's a very hard one to go back to.
Right.
But I did look up, like, just out of curiosity, like, what I looked at the How Long to Beat website, and that one is usually cited at around 5 hours. So this game is, like, three times as big. So calling it a remake, just in your head, like, remake to me conjures, like, maybe it's all new graphics, but it's, like, the same geometry and stuff.
Sure.
And it's not at all. Like, even, like, a lot of people have been comparing this to Metroid Zero Mission, which is an amazing game, and it was a remake for the Game Boy Advance of the original Metroid that added a lot of stuff and had a lot of cool surprises. But that game, if you look at it, especially in the early going, is pretty much, like, you will recognize the general rooms, the general layout of original NES Metroid. You will not, if you know the Game Boy version of Metroid 2, there will be some nice little Easter eggs and stuff, but it is not like, go left here, go right there. That won't get you anywhere in this game. This is basically borrows the premise from Metroid 2, which is that the Galactic Federation has decided that the Metroids are too much of a threat, and Samus needs to go commit genocide on them and kill all the Metroids.
Great.
So she goes to planet SR388, and that's the homeworld of the Metroids, and she has to kill them all. And in the Game Boy game, you have a little counter, and it's 39 Metroids. In the new game, it's 40 Metroids. And so I'm wondering what that change will amount to.
Nope.
But anyway, and you just have to basically, you will beat the game when you kill all those fucking Metroids.
I mean, to be fair, 40, they deserve it. Like, come on, guys, procreate a bit more. Like, you're making it way too easy to just kill all of you.
Indeed. But yes, so that was kind of the premise of Metroid 2 Return of Samus. Metroid Samus Returns is the same premise. The opening cutscene, which is really cool, kind of restates what would have been in the manual of a Game Boy Metroid, because back then a lot of the story was done in manuals, not in the game itself. But from there on out, like, once you get started, you will recognize a little bit, and then you're like, oh right, this is very different. You do have to kill all the Metroids. The Metroids appear in very different forms than they did in the Game Boy game. Some of the power-ups are the same, but there's also a shit ton of new power-ups. The world of the game is just way bigger and more expansive. There's a map system and all this crazy shit. They've also added, like, beyond just the kind of stuff that you would expect from a Metroid game at this point, like your map system and some of the new upgrades and things like that, like, you know, upgrades that were introduced in Super Metroid or something. They have also, like, Samus is way more mobile than she's ever been. So she can aim completely 360 when you hold down L, like, she freezes, and you can aim in any direction, which has never happened in a Metroid before. You also have more kind of range of movement. You also have this interesting, like, melee counter system, which is the biggest deviation the game makes from kind of Metroid, normal Metroid games, which is when an enemy comes in at you, they can do this move where when an enemy comes in, they'll have this, like, little white flash, and if you hit the X button at the right moment, Samus will hit them back, they will, like, stagger, and then you have a chance to do a shot that's really powerful and just kill them.
Cool.
Which really changes if you know 2D Metroid. That kind of changes the whole game, but it's also, I think, a really smart system. It makes, you have to be much more aggressive. You have to be a little more patient in some moments, too, but it just means that you're more kind of aware and within the combat at all times, and it's not something you kind of just run past as much. So all of that works really well. But also, like, just on top of the things they've added, the game just controls so well. When I say Samus feels more mobile than ever, there's none of the stiffness that you might, you know, you certainly had in, like, original Metroid 2, a little bit in Super Metroid here and there. Like, when I got the grapple hook or something, for instance, the grapple gun, I guess, in Metroid, same kind of idea, right?
Yeah.
In Super Metroid, which I love, it is a little, like, finicky if you can get it to work exactly. In this one, it is so smooth and works so perfectly. The one I was most surprised by is the space jump, which is the move in Metroid that allows you to just, like, basically fly. Right. You're doing a spin jump, and you can just repeat it over and over again. In Super Metroid, it can actually be pretty hard to pull off because it's not just automatic the way you do it. You have to, like, hit the button at the exact right moment. In this game, the space jump has never been easier, and it has been hard in multiple Metroid games. They added it in Metroid Prime 2, and it's a bitch to pull off in that one. Because it's also, it's not, it's, it has to go from first person to third person, right. And it's a whole weird thing. But yeah, so all of that, it plays super smoothly, and I love that about it. But it also just, they got something with this game. It's a Metroid game. And that was my first reaction, and I know that sounds obvious. Like, yeah, it says Metroid on the box, right?
Right.
But what I mean, and this is the thing that, like, with Other M, a lot of people were turned off by, is that it has to, there's something about Metroid in the atmosphere, in the DNA of these games, that is so special, and is clearly so hard to pull off, because there are way fewer Metroid games than most other major Nintendo series, you know? Right. There's four mainline 2D games, and the three Prime games. You know, and then Other M. Yeah. That's kind of it, unless you count, like, Metroid Prime Hunters, which most of us don't.
No.
Or Metroid Prime Pinball.
Sure.
Did you know that was a game?
No.
Yeah, it came with a rumble pack that you could put in the DS Game Boy Advance slot that would rumble on the pinball hits.
Good God.
I did not
know.
Hey,
you, Samus, the hit N64 Metroid game.
Yes, when Samus was out in the wilderness a little bit. No. But it
did. Metroid just, Snap.
I knew we were in good hands with Samus Returns about 10 minutes into the game, because everything is so on point. It just feels like a Metroid game. You know, Samus looks right, and she moves right, and once you start getting upgrades, they're all the things you would want. The game looks so gorgeous, and it's got just that specific Metroid atmosphere, which is that you're alone, and the world is kind of decayed and strange, but it's also got varied locations. The music is very atmospheric, but also at sometimes very catchy. There's just a tone and a feeling when you're playing Metroid that is unlike anything else. Even though Metroid has a lot of similarities to, like, The Legend of Zelda, I think, in terms of going around and getting items.
Right.
Like, I was talking about with the grapple hook, there's a lot of items, like, shared between Zelda and Metroid. But in Samus Returns, it just, all of it feels so good. And then you get into actually playing the game, and it's a little unlike other 2D Metroid games in that, you know, you're not going for, like, a series of different kind of objectives. The objective is you have to kill all the Metroids. And in each area of the map, because the map winds up being split into kind of a series of discrete zones, which is something Super Metroid does too. They're a little more bordered off in this game than they were in that one. But basically in each zone, there's a certain number of Metroids you have to kill before you can do this thing with a Chozo Ruin, and then it'll allow you to move on to the next area. And as you're going through each area, of course, you will recognize an area where, like, I'm going to need the screw attack for that later. Right. And I still don't have the screw attack, but I know it's there. Because if it wasn't, what the fuck are they doing, right?
Yeah.
But anyway, as you're playing through, it just they've designed these levels in such ingenious ways. It feels so good to just traverse around the map. And that, you know, that classic kind of, you have to be kind of a space detective and figure out, all right, I can't get through here now, but I'm going to need this, so I'm going to go this way first. And it's kind of hilarious to ever think that Metroid games didn't have a map system, because it is right. So essential to the games now, because you're always using your map and referring to it of, like, where have I been, where haven't I been, what was locked off for me, where can I go next? And I really like something they add in this game where there's these new four abilities Samus gets that they're not like equipment, they're like they're on the D-pad and you select them, and they're called Aeon abilities, and there's a new Aeon meter that allows you to use them. And one of the Aeon, they're all cool. I like how all of them work. There's some really creative ones. But the first Aeon ability you get, like, right off the bat is called the Scan Pulse. And you activate that, and it basically fills out, like, you know, 8x8 squares of your map around you. Hmm. And will also show you, like, where maybe there's some breakable objects. And I saw some people, like, complain, like, before the game came out and stuff, like, oh, that looks like they're making it too easy. Is it, like, doing the work for you? And to me, it's not at all, because the other thing they've taken out is this does not have, like, the zones where you go fill in your map, which is something they brought in with Super Metroid and right. Zero Mission and stuff, is where you'll find the map room, right?
Yeah.
And then you'll be able to go around. So now you have to map it for yourself, but that means the mapping itself becomes a cool part of the strategy, where, like, when I arrive at a new zone, I'll start using the Scan Pulse and kind of just try to get a feel for, like, what's around me. And it feels like you are Samus in her suit. Like, that's an ability she has. And she sees, like, a readout. Like, here's what's around me in this direct vicinity. And then that's, like, you can make the decision, which way am I going to go? And it's also, like, a good thing. Now you don't have to, like, just jump around and use all your missiles and your super missiles and your bombs and your power bombs to guess what is going to break this wall, if anything, because I don't know if it breaks. You can just use the scan pulse and you'll see if there's a breakable object or not. So there's a lot of really smart stuff like that, and it just makes the basic process of going around and playing the game so fun. One of the best things it does, frankly, is it just completely eschews story. It does not try to like shoehorn in a really complex Metroid story. It does the basic setup at the beginning, and then you are alone, and there's no dialogue, and the cutscenes are just these little visual things you'll get once in a while, but otherwise, you're going and you're hunting the Metroids, and the Metroid fights themselves, I think, are a lot of fun. They are a little repetitive in that there's 40, and obviously they did not design 40 unique boss fights
right.
for all the Metroids, but there are different styles of Metroids, and they get harder as you go further and further down the planet. And in general, I find those boss fights very fun, very challenging. This game is really hard. Like, it gives you so many tools and so many ways to play the game and overcome different circumstances that part of how they, I think, you know, make up for that is to just make the game a little harder than other Metroid games. But I like that. Like, it does feel like very rewarding if you know this series to try to master all these new skills and put everything together, and it becomes a very hard game to the point where, like, I'm really interested to see what, like, the hard mode is when I've beat the game, because it's already pretty tough as it is. But it's just, it's great. It's so much fun, every bit of it. And, you know, I don't think it's as revelatory a Metroid game as, obviously, Super Metroid, which invented a whole genre, or, like, you know, Metroid Zero Mission, which really felt like a surprise in terms of how it reconfigures Metroid 1. But this is just a super solid, very good Metroid game that has some really good ideas for how to redo things. It's mostly kind of a back-to-basics one. Like, of all the 2D Metroid games, this one feels the most to me like Super Metroid, I think I would say, in terms of pace and length and kind of how you move through the world. But it's also, I think, a very good one for first-time Metroid players because it's, you know, obviously very modern. It's got checkpoints, and it doesn't make you go back a long ways when you die and things like that. So it's great. And the last thing to talk about is the visuals in this game are some of the best you'll see in any game this year, even if it is on the 3DS, and actually because it's on the 3DS, because the developers, Mercury Steam, have made such amazing use of the 3D. Not in a way that, like, changes how you play the game, but just how you look at it, and they added to that Metroid atmosphere. Because what they've done is that it's a 2D game, but it has these really deep, like, varied, rich backgrounds, where, like, behind Samus will be, like, a cavern stretching way back, and in the distance there will be a bunch of stalactites, and there will be a river of lava, and there might even sometimes be, like, a monster, like, flying around back there. And it's not something you're going to face, it's just, like, there's stuff going on all the way behind you, and if you have the 3D on, which you absolutely should, the game, like, it extends to such a depth, it looks like you could just walk into the screen and walk for a mile before you reach the back of what they've animated. It's insane. It's impossible to describe unless you've played the game with the 3D on. It's not the kind of really deep 3D that gives eye strain either. It's just really visually interesting, and it adds so much to the game where this world feels so alive out there behind Samus. I've never seen anything like it, and I generally think the 3D on the 3DS is used in pretty good, interesting ways, but this is a really visually fascinating one, where when I've turned off the 3D and looked at it, it just feels like a different game to some degree, because you don't get that sense of background depth. Like, they have done some really cool, smart things with this.
Cool.
Yeah, so if you have a 3DS, you should be playing Metroid Samus Returns. If you are not playing with the 3D on, you should be. If you own a 2DS, still play it. Still good. But you might
cross your eyes a little bit. You might kind of see it.
Yeah, it's like a magic eye image. Yeah. No, but there's a new Metroid game, Sean, and it's so good. And we're going to talk about Destiny 2 in a bit. And Destiny 2 is fantastic, and I've really enjoyed it. It's no match for Metroid. It's like getting a hit of something. It's so good. Metroid Return of Samus Returns. I get it mixed up. Nintendo gets it mixed up because I got the amiibo figures that came with this game. You had to buy them separately, obviously. Right. But on the back of the box of the amiibos, it says, use these in Metroid Return of Samus. And it's like, I understand how you made the mistake, but that's not the name of your game.
Yes. Like, let me go get my Game Boy.
Yes. No. And I should say, the amiibo that came with this, if you can get their hands on them, One is Samus in the pose she has on the box, which is the pose from Metroid 2, and it's an awesome amiibo. But the other one is a Metroid that has broken out of its containment shell, and so it's like the containment shell, and it's like this jagged broken glass. Not, it's plastic. They didn't really put jagged broken glass in there.
Damn it.
Yeah, but then the actual Metroid is like really big. It's actually squishy, like you can like the shell where like it's got its, you know, gelatinous like jellyfish kind of thing. You can squeeze. It's really cool, and I have all four of the Metroid amiibo because I had picked up the other two at some point over the years, and all of them do cool little add-ons in the game that like are central enough. They gave you basically a reserve tank for Aeon missiles and energy, and it's central enough to how I play the game that it feels a little skeevy to me, sure, as amiibo always do. But you know, I don't know. I own them already, so fuck it.
Sure, yeah, that's the attitude to have.
But Metroid Returns or Samus Returns. I cannot wait to go home and play more of it. It's a great game.
Cool.
Yeah.
Want to talk about another great game, Jonathan?
Maybe.
Let's talk about Destiny 2.
Do you think Destiny 2 is great?
Yeah, I love it. Okay. I think it's a fantastic game.
All right. I have not talked to you about it at all, yeah, and my voice hurts. So talk about Destiny 2, Sean.
All right, Destiny 2. So the only way to talk about Destiny 2, I think, is to first talk about Destiny 1, right?
Uh-huh.
And if you want to read a lot about the development of Destiny 1, there's a really great article already on Kotaku, but then also Jason Schreier goes really in-depth in Blood, Sweat, and Pixels. And so Destiny 1, you know, a huge game when it came out, and like a hugely successful game. I think like people don't often appreciate just how well Destiny sells, because I think the story of Destiny gets in the way of like these games, like Destiny 1 and Destiny 2 both have sold extremely well. But Destiny 1 was, you know, the successor to Bungie's, you know, legacy with Halo, and is a very, was at the time and still is, an incredibly unique game in this blend of sort of like Diablo kind of loot stuff, MMO-esque, like a shared world, co-op kind of stuff, and then, you know, like the Bungie-style first-person shooter with RPG kind of like level and ability mechanics thrown on top of it. Really unique game. Everyone was super excited. Destiny 1 came out, and it was a weird game with weird problems, and just had a lot of holes in places that then when you learned the story of the game's development, it was basically they had sort of made a lot of the game and had all the combat stuff and a lot of like, oh, like the races are basically, the enemies are basically done, and there's like a lot of the basic ideas for the loot and that stuff is in place, but then a lot of the larger structural elements of the game, including the story, were heavily overhauled very late into development, to the point where the story was completely thrown out and redone and like restitched together with what they had already made, and it ended up coming out as like this weird patchwork game that had this brilliant core inside of it that was like, you know, some of the most satisfying like first-person gameplay, first-person shooter gameplay there had ever been. All these really unique, interesting ideas of how to structure a like kind of new kind of game that we had never seen before. And then also just really great visuals, great music, an incredible just sense of art to it, and a really interesting lore around the edges that you never dug into. So it had that like core there, but everything else about it sort of fell flat and didn't work that well.
Although we should say we were super into Destiny when it came out. If you want to go listen back to our podcasts,
and millions of people were like really into it. And the weird thing about being into Destiny was like you loved that game, you played the shit out of that game, but everyone understood all of its problems and had problems with its problems, but it was all that anyone fucking ever talked about. It's hugely successful. And if you follow any game journalists on Twitter and you go back to their feeds from like 2014, I remember seeing tweets all over the place about people being like, yo, if you're getting tired of Destiny stories, well, there's a good reason why we have 100 Destiny stories on our homepage, is because they do crazy well. And everybody's super interested in this game, even if everybody acknowledges and recognizes its problems.
I mean, I just remember the fall of 2014, Sean, in our apartment.
It
was just Destiny all the time.
Uh-huh.
We were playing it, we were talking about it, we were podcasting about it. It was crazy, and it was just the tip of the iceberg.
Yes, and so that was where it sort of started. And then you had the two small expansion packs, the Dark Below and the House of Wolves, that slowly were sort of like trying to be like, okay, there's this incredible core to this game, and we have like cultivated this really rabid audience that is like fascinated by and obsessed with this core here, but everything else is not super great. Like, the end game of the vanilla Destiny was so absurd with, like, you're having to get your light level up, which was incredibly obscured from you, and you had to get fucking strange coins and motes of light and 500 different reputation things and Vanguard coins and Crucible coins and like, all this stuff. There's no clear perspective on... how do I, like, what do I do in this game when I finish the story? And, like, what do I do? How do I get more gear? And you had, like, you would be able to get a legendary engram and go back to the fucking Cryptarch to get it, you know, basically, you know, it identified in, like, Diablo terms as an item. And then you would get it identified. And, oh, this legendary engram, guess what? It doesn't have a legendary item. It has, like, a blue rare item in it because fuck you. And it's like, that was something that could happen to Destiny 1. Like, all those, these weird problems that made no sense. And they slowly started fixing it with the Dark Below, and then particularly the House of Wolves did a lot of stuff, and the House of Wolves was a pretty good small expansion pack. And then you had Destiny Year 2, which totally overhauled the game. You know, they kicked Peter Dinklage to the curb and said, hello, Nolan North. We obviously made a huge issue in getting this, like, really big Hollywood star to voice, like, our only, like, main voiced character, really, in the game that's with you all the time that we obviously would never be able to get back and would not want to do this over and over again. So instead, let's get, you know, professional video game actor Nolan North, because we know that he will come to the studio and record more lines when we make more Destiny. So they got Nolan North in, they completely overhauled the original game, put in a new end game, and then The Taken King came out that added a lot of new content that was really great. The Taken King, who was the creative director on that, was Luke Smith, who is now the creative director on Destiny 2. And that started to turn the game around, and then you had the Rise of Iron expansion early last year, which was... okay, but, like, that existed as a stopgap because they had to push Destiny 2 back another year because the development on Destiny 2 had to be reset to sort of realign with where Destiny 1 had gone. And so the development in the history of Destiny is this weird history of this incredible core game that has this, like, rolling train wreck around it that is slowly getting better and better as it goes along, and the bullshit is flying off of it and you're getting closer to that core. And that's kind of like and it's like Bungie trying to sort of catch up to this monster that it's made and sort of wrangle that monster and get it under control because it was not under control, right?
And put another way, Destiny 2 gets us very close to the center of that Tootsie Pop.
Exactly. We are a couple of steps closer. It's like Destiny 2 is not a perfect game, but holy shit, is Destiny 2 not Destiny that has gotten the fuck out of its own way. Is how I like to think about it. It is like Destiny 2 is they it is not this radically different game at its core in terms of like the you know the combat and some of like the ideas of like how to structure the game, but Destiny 2 just feels like they have taken a look at every single piece of Destiny 1 and looked at it and said, like, how do we make something that like feels like Destiny 1 but just has all of this bullshit cut out and feels like Destiny, like they made Destiny 1 on purpose is what Destiny 2 is.
Yes.
Instead of like they made Destiny 1 on accident, which is what Destiny 1 was.
And that's what I was saying earlier, which is that Destiny 1 was made by a bunch of people who had no clear vision for what the game needed to be. Or they had a bunch of particulate visions but no overall vision. Destiny 2 feels like it was clear-eyed. Again, not perfect, no game is, but... I don't know if I can think of another analog for the improvement between Destiny 1 and Destiny 2. Like, and you realize it about an hour into Destiny 2, because what they start doing almost right off the bat, just if you compare the campaign of Destiny 2 to vanilla Destiny 1, like, it is ludicrous how much better this game is, and just in all avenues, how much better a job it does at letting you have fun with the game. I cannot think of a good analog. Destiny 2 is a really unique case to me. Because I went into this expecting, you know, better Destiny 1. I think it's more than that. Yeah. I think it's its own thing, and I think it's really, really good at what it does.
Like, for me, there's almost something about Destiny 2 where, like, the nature of what it's done is it just feels like, it in so many ways, is what Destiny has always, like... seen itself as and wanted to be, that, like, in my mind, Destiny 2 isn't a different game. It's just Destiny, and this is just what Destiny is now.
No, right? I totally understand,
like,
yeah.
It's that weird thing of where there are a lot of reasons why it needs to be a Destiny 2 and has to, like, be this fresh new base to which to build from now, which is one of the best things about Destiny 2 is you can see how it serves as this really nice rock solid base to build from instead of the unstable base that Destiny 1 was. But it is like, it so captures and is that core of what Destiny was and is that it's just like, it's just Destiny. Like, Destiny 2 is the story campaign, but Destiny, but like, the game is still just Destiny to me.
No, totally.
Just move on to this new platform.
Yeah, it's like when my brother and I, we decide to play some Destiny 2, you know, I just say, do you want to play some Destiny?
Exactly.
It's, or what I really think the game should have been called, Destoony.
No.
Which is really what I wanted it, but that's not what they called it.
Like, Nintendo fucked up with Splatoon 2 not being Splatoon, because that is exactly the tone of that game. I don't think you could get away with Destiny 2 being Destiony.
It's just, I've done the rant before, no one is doing this. We didn't get Gears of 4, we're not getting God of 4, we didn't get Splatoon, we're not getting it, we didn't get Transformers. It's pissing me off. Someone needs to write this ship, or else our culture will not survive.
I've got bad news for you, Jonathan. Our culture is not going to survive.
Okay.
But we've got a lot of Destiny 2 to play in the meantime.
Well, yes, we do.
Yeah.
I mean, where do you want to start now, talking about the game?
Let's start with, like, the main campaign, because I think that is...
Here's one of the most interesting things about the campaign. We'll talk about how good it is in a second. Here's how you know how much they've improved it, is that Destiny 2 makes a really interesting structural choice in that while you're playing the campaign, they mostly block you off from everything else.
Yeah, you don't get to go do strikes, you don't get to go do patrols, you don't get your, like, sparrow bike until you get to the end of the campaign.
Yeah, you can do some Crucible if you want, although it feels like, diegetically, you shouldn't be able to in some sense. But yeah, they really block off most of the things, and that is one of the biggest differences, because Destiny 1... to put it mildly, was not a propulsive experience through the main campaign.
Yeah.
Like, I often would take a break to go play Strikes or go play Crucible or something. Destiny 2 wants you to focus on that campaign. And they open up at each, you know, like, kind of juncture in the campaign a number of activities for you to do, and you can do them in any order. But it does feel like they want you to do all of it, and they're never going to overwhelm you. They don't give you, like, 17 adventures. They give you 2, 3, or 4. And they want you to, like, live with it and do all of it and get to the end, and then the game will open up. On one level, that means the end game is much richer than it was in vanilla Destiny. But it also means that they are saying, we are confident enough in this campaign that it can stand on its own. And they should be, because this is a great Bungie first-person shooter campaign.
Yeah. And it is something where that structure is really important, because it makes it, I think, much more clear what the game is. That, like, you go through that campaign, and, like, so if you, like, it opens up some of these, you know, side adventure, like, basically side missions along the way that you get to go do that stuff, and you can kind of mess around with Crucible a little bit, but it is, like, very focused in, like, you're going to play through this campaign. As you go through the campaign, we are going to open up some little things to you, but it, like, it feels like the campaign is structured in such a way to introduce you to all, like, the basics of what this game is, like, of, like, you know, you get your first subclass, and then a little bit later, after you played some, you get access to another subclass. You get, you know, they seed some exotic armor, and, like, one piece of exotic armor and one exotic weapon into the campaign that you get along the way, basically mandatory, so you get exposed to, this is the kind of gear you're going to be playing with at the end of the game that really changes things up, because it has a special ability associated with it. Which in Destiny 1, you didn't see that fucking at all until you were, like, deep into the end game and got your first exotic. You didn't even know, really, that was, like, a dimension of the game. It puts that in there and puts that in, like, okay, that's going to be where I'm going. Like, you go and visit all the planets, you fight all the different races, kind of, like, one after another, get introduced to all the basic variants of all the different races, get introduced to all the different characters, and sort of their setting, and kind of the concept of, you know, delivering missions to them and getting your reputation up with them. It introduces all those things to funnel you then into a pretty quickly, because the campaign's a decent length, but it's not hugely long. And then once you get to the end, then it opens everything up and it feels like you're prepared. And I think there's this better understanding of that sensation of the real game starts here, which is an element of all of those kinds of games. It's like the real game starts once you finish the story and you've gotten to see that conclusion. And, like, that's like the future is here. Like, the future starts now. And that the campaign is important and fantastic and brilliant. And I love it. But it really exists to get you into this much bigger experience of the kind of loot-based game that Destiny 2 and Destiny 1 is. And I think the structure of the campaign is much better at delivering that idea to you in Destiny 2 than it was in Destiny 1.
It's interesting, because I don't disagree with anything you just said. And I think definitely in structure, that's what it's all built to do. But when you said, like, you know, the real game starts here at the end,
yeah.
I do agree with that, because that's how the game is built. That's, to me, it's kind of just a statement of fact, right? Because that's how this kind of game is. But while that is the case, it's a weird thing where I almost think they did too good a job at the campaign for that. And it's something I didn't want to talk about, which is that I have definitely enjoyed going back to Destiny 2 and fooling around with it since I beat the campaign and all that and getting into the strikes and Crucible and all that. I'm having a lot of fun with it. The campaign is so good. I have felt the pull that I, at a lot of points, I would rather just go start another character and play through it again because sure. I think it has such beautiful visuals. It takes you through all these amazing worlds. It has such amazing music. I think the specific level design is all so smart and so good. Like, you could just have taken that and sold it as its own thing without everything else.
Sure.
And it's like a Halo game. I don't think it's as deep as a Halo game, but it is a really, really good first-person shooter campaign, and, like, the character work is so fun. The voice acting is so phenomenally good. Like, there is a part of me that just thinks, like, they did all of that so fucking well, and we'll get into it, that when you get to the end and it's, you know, the same small batch of strikes and it's Crucible and Patrol stuff, there's a lot of fun stuff to discover. I do miss at some points the structure that that campaign gave and how much Bungie felt like they were flourishing in that environment.
Sure. I mean, but also obviously, like, you can only make so much of that stuff.
Absolutely.
So it's like, eventually you're going to run out no matter what you do.
Absolutely. And look, if we learned anything from vanilla Destiny back in the day, the lesson with Destiny is once you get tired of it, just stop playing it
yes,
for a while.
Yes, exactly, yeah.
And I might be at that point for a little bit, but I will come back to it. It'll always be there for you. Yeah. And one thing they do nicely is they never overwhelm you with stuff so that you feel like it's a job or yeah. something. But I do feel like there's just... I missed it a little bit when I got to the end, and that is ultimately, I think, a compliment,
right.
I think. Like, is that because I think they just did it so well. And, you know, my favorite thing to do in Destiny 1 was never in vanilla Destiny to go back and play the campaign missions again.
Yeah.
And if anything, I do wish they had a more robust structure for replaying those things in the end game, and we'll talk about that later. They have something with Ikora, but it's not exactly the same as what they had before
yeah.
in Destiny 1. But yeah, so you want to talk about that campaign?
Yeah, let's talk about the campaign.
Because we talked about how it started with the beta.
Yes.
And we same as in the beta. They blow up the tower, but good.
Yes.
It's a great...
Yeah, the Cabal come in, the Red Legion, led by Dominus Gaul.
Who is a great video game villain.
Fantastic villain. And they really capture that, like, Roman Empire element to the Cabal, which has always been a part of, like, their visual design and stuff.
Yeah.
But it's never been... Because you never got much insight into them as a species, because they were never heavily featured in Destiny 1, where you had expansions about the Horde... Or about the Horde, or the Hive, you had expansions about the Fallen and stuff about the Vex. You never really got much about the Cabal, and here you get the sense of, like, yes, these are, like, weird space Romans that have come here from outside our solar system, have arrived, and they want our shit, they want the Traveler, and they want the Light, and they want this power, and so they have this big giant clamp that clamps onto the Traveler, is stealing the Light, and steals the Light when you confront Dominus Gaul, and he basically beats you up and kicks you off of the tower and says, you know, go home, Guardian. This isn't your home anymore. Like leave.
Great intro to the game. Yeah. We'll talk about what happens next in just a second.
Sure.
I did just get an alert on my phone.
Okay.
Elizabeth Moss did win her Emmy, finally, for The Handmaid's Tale. That show actually won all the drama stuff. Julia Louis-Dreyfus won her 6th consecutive Emmy for Veep, which is a record, which I think is awesome because Julia Louis-Dreyfus is cool. So if you wanted me to give my hot take on that, that's good. I actually have not seen The Handmaid's Tale yet, but I need to. It seems like kind of a sad show. So
yes,
I want to.
Yes, yeah.
I want to be in
read
the,
that book. Yeah.
I want to be in the headspace for it.
Uh-huh.
But I am glad Elizabeth Moss finally has her fucking Emmy, and that they seem to have given it to a good show. That's nice. Also, I think that's the first streaming show to win Best Drama. That's a Hulu show.
Oh, yeah, it is, yeah.
So that's kind of a big moment. And you'd be happy Black Mirror won a ton of shit.
Cool.
So
yeah, I have not gone and watched the season 3 Black Mirror because I haven't found the time to.
But I know you like that show.
Yes, yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, that was really good.
What I was going to say about Dominus Gaul is that, so he kicks you off and you fall to Earth. Did you have any idea what they were going to do next? Because
no, yeah, because that's exactly where the beta ends, is with that cutscene, and I think they put the title there. And
yeah.
You're like, okay, I guess I can go play the strike now.
Yeah, no. What they do is that they basically do a Naughty Dog sequence, which
yeah,
is that you are almost like that sequence from Nier Automata, where you are stumbling around, broken, you find your ghost, you have none of your powers. You have
your
none
ghost
of your
is totally fucked up, and he's just like broken, and sparks are popping out of him.
And basically, you go on a hunt for the Light of the Traveler because there's a shard somewhere.
You get this really beautiful cutscene that is like this vision you see of this hawk going and finding like arriving at this shard.
And you basically play. It's this amazing. It's a kind of sequence that Bungie has never done before in Halo or in Destiny or anything. Where it's kind of like half cinematic, half, you know, player, you know, motivated, where you're moving through these spaces as you're on this long journey, beautiful music is playing, and you realize, oh God, they have stepped up their game on literally everything, including the music. And you just move through this until you get to the Light of the Traveler. And I didn't realize Destiny could make me emotional. I could have fun with it. I could occasionally laugh at it. But I didn't realize it could make me sort of feel things, and that sequence made me feel things because it's visually beautiful, it's orally beautiful, it has some actual like weight behind what's going on, and that sets the tone for the entire game. There's not another sequence like that, but the story does have weight, it has really good characters that you care about, and most importantly, it has stakes that feel very real, even if you know in the back of your head it's going to end with us, you know, beating the bad guy.
Right.
It never feels that inevitable, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And from that point on, it's like that is one of those great video game moments that to me defines how Destiny 2 changed all of its own rules in a weird way.
Yeah, and it's something where they did so much right narratively with this game. Like, and I'm not going to sit here and tell you it's like, as you know, the best story of video games ever. But especially when you compare it to fucking Destiny 1.
Yeah.
Which Destiny 1 at launch didn't have a story, basically.
Or even like, you know, the Taken King and Rise of Iron are fun. There's no depth to them.
Yeah.
There's no real sense of stakes. It's just fun, kind of silly goofiness. This has some of that goofiness, but I was happy to see it's tempered with a real sense of like world building and depth.
Yeah, and I think one of the big things they do is they leverage a lot of like the texture of that world, which has always been fascinating and driven by this really great art design and interesting pieces of information and lore in the edges of the world that were always there. And if you know, are a crazy person, which I've read some of the Grimoire cards. I've never gone like super deep into them because it's kind of scary. But those things are interesting, and like those are the ideas of Destiny are so interesting, and the specific brand of like space mysticism of Destiny, and all the different like the weird, you know, time traveling future robots in the Vex, and like the machine worshipping aliens in the Fallen, and space Romans with the Cabal, and then just like interdimensional demons like basically from Doom practically with the Hive, all these different like mismatched weird sci-fi concepts and sci-fi races all thrown together with this like very spiritual core around the Traveler, which is this mysterious alien artifact or entity or something that has arrived at Earth and delivered to Earth this golden age of history, but then following it was the darkness, which then, you know, drove humanity to the point of extinction and to the point where we're at the last city of Earth. Like, all of those ideas are so fascinating, but you never were confronted much with them and never confronted much with, like, I think more directly those larger spiritual elements of the story. And I like that Destiny 2 really front loads that here. And also finds, what to me is the most important thing, is it finds like a core theme for the story to work around that I think actually resonated for me like surprisingly well, which is it plays off of some of the like narrative failings of Destiny 1, where the story of Destiny has always been this idea of that, of like humanity was pushed to the brink of extinction and is assaulted on all sides by all these different alien forces, but we're trying to sort of reclaim, you know, our space and our world and our solar system from all these aliens. And we, like you, the player, and your friends are the chosen guardians that wield the light of the Traveler, that are immortal, have been brought back from the dead to be these immortal warriors and these defenders of humanity who live. But you live in this, like, literally, in this ivory tower that overlooks the last city on Earth. And never do you talk to normal people. Like, never do you go into the last city. You sit up here and look over this stuff, but you're so distant from it. And, like, that side of the premise was always foreign to you. And there's always been this element of Destiny of, like, of, you know, the Guardians are sort of this, like, hoity-toity upper class that, like, is so removed from the actual concerns and problems of the people that they claim to defend. It's very analogous to me of like the prequel Jedi stuff from Star Wars, of that that some point you are too distant, too removed, too monk-like to actually like understand what you're dealing with. Which to me, like, that was always just like a narrative oversight of Destiny 1, was that you have this like core premise that you never actually tackle and directly engage with. But what I like about Destiny 2 is I think it pulls that weird oversight into the narrative. And it starts with this, like, you have achieved so much. You are this great guardian. You have, you know, you've, like, went and conquered the Black Garden. And you vanquished Oryx. And you blah, blah, blah. You did, like, you know, you captured Skolas. You did all the things of Destiny. And it has this whole, like, slideshow that shows you all your achievements with your original character. And you start in that super high place. And then the Cabal come out of nowhere and knock you out of that ivory tower, and you get your light taken from you. You are vulnerable. You are mortal. Zavala and the rest of the Vanguard are all mortal and have to deal with that and have to deal with being pulled from the light. And when you fall, you are saved by Hawthorne, who is a normal human. Who is just like a normal human person that used to live in the city and left the city because she didn't like being contained there, because to her it was basically a prison. And, you know, it doesn't... I'm not going to say that the story in Destiny 2, like, dives super, super deep into all these questions. And it is this... Again, it's not, like, the most revelatory story ever. But it does have that core theme there that it touches upon throughout the whole story. That, to me, is what the story is about, is what does it mean to be worthy of the light of the Traveler? And at the beginning of the game, I think the Guardians are not. And that's why they are defeated. And that's why they have to be thrown from grace. And then they have to, through their achievements and through hard work, work their way back up to that grace. And that's, like, I think it's very effective at delivering that story in a straightforward way.
I agree completely. And it... Yeah, it's not like it gets into extreme, you know, ultimate depth on all of these topics, but it has a theme, it sticks with that theme through the game, it sees it through to the end beautifully, and most importantly, this does not feel like a game made by people confused by the game's lore.
Yeah.
This feels like a game made by people who love this world, and love these characters, and love these ideas, and have nothing but enthusiasm for bringing it all to life. And, you know, if you look at, like, Luke Smith's background of rising to the point where he's directing Destiny 2, he basically was a guy within Bungie who was, like, a super fan of Destiny, of this weird game they made, and he just, like, he was kind of the guy at the studio who loved it most, and could see that core, you know, as we said, the center of the Tootsie Pop, and just wanted to show it to everyone else. And you can feel that enthusiasm in what's happening in the story, I think.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's also a great video game story in the tradition of, I think, Bungie's best moments in the past, where it's enough of a story to give you some meat and give you some things to think about and laugh at and have fun with and feel emotional for and feel attachment to. But it also drives a video game, you know, in that everything you do brings you to another planet. And it's you always have good reason for going to a new planet or finding a new ability or having to, you know, do this challenge here or whatever. It feels like everything you do is it's this constant feedback loop where everything that happens in the story feeds the gameplay and everything you do in the gameplay feeds back to the story. And that's the golden ticket for all of this.
Yeah.
And it just makes it all feel so, as I said, propulsive. Like, I couldn't put this game down.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, it's awesome. And then, like, the other piece of that puzzle for that, what makes that story work, is that you have Dominus Gall, who is this fantastic antagonist that I love. They do this thing of every once in a while you cut to, you have this, like, it puts up the Red Legion logo, and that means you're in for a real good, like full-on, like, CG cinematic cutscene that looks so beautiful, and where you just get a visit in on Dominus Gall and him with the speaker, which they got Bill Nighy back. Voice the speaker. If you forgot that he was in Destiny 1, so did everybody. But they got him back, and he's the speaker for the Traveler and Dominus Gall. And you just get these nice scenes of him with the speaker. And then my favorite character in the game, which is Dominus's, like, lieutenant dude or whatever, who's, like, the guy who actually raised him. It's
so Shakespearean.
It's very Shakespearean. It's super fucking Roman. It's so good. And you just get... One of my favorite moments in the whole game is that first cutscene after you're, like, the first time you sort of visit Dominus Gall in one of those cutscenes, and you meet this other, like, this older Cabal guy, this general who has sort of, like, Gall is the leader, but Gall was sort of, like, propped up and brought up by this other guy who has sort of, like, put Gall into the position he's in. And so, but you have this guy, and the way they talk about the Traveler at first is, like, it's this machine to them. They don't see it as some sort of god. And the fact, like, they find it funny that the Guardians and the humans worship this machine like a god. And they just recognize it as, like, it's an incredibly powerful machine. But that's what it is. And I love that perspective. I love that idea that for this alien race, that's all it is. And maybe it's something more than that. And maybe it isn't. Like, but I love that, Again, you get this very Roman thing of that they conquer, because also Dominus Gaul's story is that you conquer this race and you conquer this area. But the thing that always happened with the Romans is that they would conquer a place and they would install governors there, and they'd be like, we're going to go back to Rome. And, like, you governors, like, you make sure that you just get, like, basically all the good shit from these people here, from, like, the Celts or whatever in England. It wasn't England yet, but England, and send it back to us. Like, you know, like, that's what we want. And the Romans like to have a certain amount of distance, or, like, tried to put up a certain amount of distance between their culture and the cultures that they overtook. But there was always this weird fascination of taking gods and taking figures and adopting things, you know, like the Roman pantheon is just the Greek pantheon. And they would do that with Egyptian gods. They did that with, like, Celtic mythic figures. They did that with all these different things and sort of, like, incorporating that into their own culture in weird ways. And that, to me, like, rings really true with the Dominus Gaul character, that he becomes really obsessed with and fascinated by the Traveler and wants to earn the light from the Traveler instead of just taking it for himself, because I think he's pulled in by this drama and by this spiritual perspective that he's so attracted to. It also has, like, a very Heart of Darkness component to it as well, which there's good reasons for that as well. But I think there's a lot of, again, it's not the richest character ever drawn in the world, but, like, for, specifically for Destiny, and I think even for most video games, villains are typically not very well constructed characters, and Dominus Gaul is, like, a villain that has actual depth that I'm really interested in, and every time they cut to him, I was really excited to see, like, where has this guy gone? Because his character arc is so interesting to me.
I want the Dominus Gaul DLC.
Yes. I want to play as Dominus Gaul rising up in the Cabal ranks in, like, some fucking galaxy, you know, super far away from us.
It'd be great. No, it's so funny because you're talking about all this lore, like the Traveler and the Light, and that humanity was brought up by the Traveler, and then there was the Darkness and all that. Sean, for the majority of Destiny 1's 3-year lifespan, I could not have told you any of that. I could not tell you what the Traveler was. I could not tell you what it did.
Yeah, it's helpful that they remind you of all of it at the beginning of Destiny 2, isn't it?
It is. But here's the thing. Like, and I know all of it now,
yeah,
but I didn't before. Here's one of the best examples of that. Whenever there's a part in the campaign of Destiny or a strike or something where you, when you die, you'll go back to a checkpoint, it's called a Darkness Zone.
Uh-huh.
In Destiny 1... from the day I started to September 6th when Destiny 2 came out, I could not tell you what Darkness Zone meant. I just thought it was a cool term they picked.
Uh-huh.
In Destiny 2, 20 minutes in, I realized what that meant because they go into it. It's a Darkness Zone because the light of the Traveler is what resurrects you. That's an actual diegetic thing in
the
game.
Yes, yeah.
And when you don't have the light, you can't be resurrected. That's why it's a Darkness Zone. And I remember going like, oh!
Yeah, like you had... like, totally forgotten or not realized that the whole respawn mechanic of Destiny is actually a diegetic part of the lore of that game.
Had no idea, and it's hilarious that not only do they bring all that stuff in, they leverage it to tell a story. Like, the lack of light and the presence of darkness and all these things, and you being worthy of the light, or Dominus trying to be worthy of the light. These are all ideas that not only feel like something I could repeat to someone else when I'm done with the campaign, but feel like they meant something for the story. And that's what really matters, right? Yeah. And all of that is just fascinating. And to transition into the next thing I wanted to talk about, which is the characters.
Yeah.
In Vanilla Destiny, I could not have told you the names Ikora, Cade, or Zavala.
Right.
I could not have told them to you. I just couldn't, because they were Nathan Fillion... the girl from Firefly.
Yes.
And
Lance Reddick.
Lance Reddick, who I was going to call Lieutenant Daniels from The Wire. Like, and those are the guys, and I go talk to the robot dude because I'm a hunter or something, right, you know? That's all it was, and all they did was stand there and make some pithy comments. And they experimented with turning them into more of characters in the expansions, but here, they're like the heart and soul of this fucking game.
Yeah.
They are brilliant characters, and what's most amazing to me is that those actors, Nathan Fillion, Lance Reddick, and Gina Torres, all come ready to play. They are not phoning this in.
Right, and they were, like, the original actors for those characters from Destiny 1.
Yeah, and it just turned out that all of them are into doing this, which is awesome. I mean, Nathan Fillion, you give him some good writing, he'll do anything for it.
Also, Lance Reddick is obsessed with Destiny. He actually plays the games, which I love that detail so much.
Because knowing his other film roles, I wouldn't imagine him as that. But, of course, he is not the characters he plays. He's a person.
And I feel like you can so feel that in his performance of Zavala, how much he loves being in this game.
That's what I was going to say. say is that I think the best performance in this game is Lance Reddick, because he's doing this with every bit as much seriousness as he did The Wire or something. And it's hilarious if you know some of his other roles that he is taking, because he is an actor with such weight to his words, and he has such a great voice and all that. And he brings all of that to Zavala, and he is not phoning it in an inch. He is giving it 110%. And he has some lines in this game that are just fucking great. And, you know, on the other side, Nathan Fillion is very funny, very good. He is giving it 100%. Yeah. Gina Torres, who is always awesome and underused in things. We don't get enough Gina Torres in the world, and she is awesome in this. And my only wish is that now we get a role in Destiny somewhere from Gina Torres' husband, Lawrence Fishburne.
Yes!
So they can be together again, and I want Lawrence Fishburne in Destiny.
Fucking yes, that would be awesome.
He can be the new speaker.
Sure, yeah, we need one.
Yeah.
It would be nice, yeah.
I know Lawrence Fishburne and Gina Torres enjoy acting together. They were on Hannibal.
Yes, they were.
Good stuff. So, yeah, but no, they're all great. And then there's
Mads Mikkelsen should be the next villain in Destiny, the next expansion pack. Fucking get him to voice some, like, fallen lieutenant or something. Please, that would be amazing.
And he just gives long philosophical speeches.
Yes, yes, I want, like, this, like, fallen, like, King of Kells or whatever that, like, rise up and, like, try to unite the fallen. That's very philosophical. God, it would be so good.
It'd be great. No, but what we do have is wonderful. All of those actors are great. I've been a Titan in Destiny 2, and I love being a Titan because Zavala is the fucking best.
Yeah.
But, you have those characters, but you also have... It's easy to overlook Nolan North as Ghost, and you shouldn't, because he's amazing in this game.
Yeah, he does a lot to anchor the story, because they... One thing I think probably everyone has forgotten about Destiny 1 is that for the campaign of Destiny 1, your character has a voice. They talk... They have, like, there's, like, 6 or 7 lines in the whole game, but your character does speak in Destiny 1, but in the expansions and in Destiny 2, that is not the case.
Right.
So Ghost speaks for you, like, in so many ways, and is with you the whole game, and in cutscenes, like, I mean, they actually make a couple of jokes about it at certain points of where characters are clearly talking to you, and then Ghost has to answer for you, which I like when that happens. But yeah, like, I think you're right. It is an easy role to overlook because it's not the most flashy character, but it's a really good, solid character.
And, you know, I think they got better at writing Ghost in Taken King and Rise of Iron and all that. But I think here they know what they want that character to be. And Nolan North is another actor. Just, he could phone this in. He's Nolan North. They're not going to fire him or anything. But no, he's doing really great work. He is funny. He also anchors, I think, a lot of the emotional material. Because again, he's your Cortana in this game, basically. And he's also experienced, you know, the lack of light. And just, I think he has painted such a visual picture for me as Ghost that obviously was never there with Peter Dinklage or even, you know, Taken King Ghost, which is this... You know, I imagine him as like this, he sounds so youthful because he has this fundamental optimism in the world and in you and in the light, but he also, you know, he knows sadness, he knows loss, and I think he is a character who you do feel a real connection to by the end of this game, and, you know, Nolan North is always good in everything and it's easy to take him for granted, but I think what he has given to Destiny is immeasurable.
Yeah, because it is like, it's a real testament to that character in like, what they have, how they have like brought that character up and made you really care about him. That at the beginning of Destiny 2, when he gets all smushed and you pull him out in your palm, and he's just like kind of floating there a little bit lower, and there's sparks coming out, and he's just kind of crushed a little bit. You're like, oh, it broke my heart. It's like, I can't, I need you to be fixed, Ghost, because I can't look at you this way. It's killing me.
But like, the highest praise I can give him is that, you know, I don't think Ghost is as deep and revelatory a character as Cortana in Halo, but I feel for him the same way I feel for, like, when I hear Jen Taylor in my ear in Halo, which is that, like, it's comfortable, but in a meaningful way. Like, this is Destiny to me, is going around the universe with my, you know, AI buddy in my head.
Yeah, because it's something where, because I do really enjoy playing solo Destiny. That is something that's, like, it's a nice, relaxing experience, and something that there's about that of, like, there is this psychological component of when you're playing Destiny on your own. That's like, that Ghost is always with you. And whenever you, like, pick up a new mission or do a patrol thing or whatever, he chimes in and you always, and, you know, you pull him out to go to your director and stuff like that. He's your companion there. And that was true of Destiny 1 as well, that they just, like, that closeness and that, you know, proximity to him. It there's a relationship that builds there no matter what, just on, like, a player level that I think they've done a really good job of cultivating.
You know, I think they've really opened the door for a great Destiny 3 where we can meet Ghost's long-lost brother, voiced by Troy Baker.
Exactly. And yes, yeah, and he's kind of a dirtbag ghost. It's like, yeah.
No, it's going to be good. But what other characters do we have? Hawthorne is a great character.
Yeah, I really like it. In fact, she's so good that I wish there was more of her. Like, if there's one thing I think the story sort of misses a beat on, and I think it's just a hard thing to do with the kind of game that Destiny is you have what I think is a really great moment early on in the game when you switch from kind of that, like, Act 1 to Act 2, where you go from sort of, like, trying to build yourself back up and get the light and sort of, like, find a foundation, to then Act 2 is, like, going to all the planets and finding your different guardians, and then Act 3 is, like, taking back the tower. And at the end of that sort of Act 1 part, you receive that signal from Zavala, and you decide, I need to go to Titan, I need to, like, get this shit together. And Hawthorne's like, you can't just leave. We're doing important stuff here. We need your help. And I wish that they revisited that in a stronger way when you come back at the beginning of Act 3 and that relationship was built up a little bit stronger with her, because she's a really good character, and that's a really, like, I think that's a strong point. And I think they could have had a couple of missions when you get back to Earth that address that more directly before you shift into full, like, take back the tower mode.
Well, because she definitely comes across the strongest of, like, the four new characters, one on each planet. I mean, she's not, like, as funny as Failsafe, which we'll talk about.
Yeah.
But she is, the strongest in terms of, like, an actual character. But I think in Act 1 you don't realize, oh, she's the first of several we're going to meet. Well, I guess that would be Devrim K.
They kind of, like, are both.
Yeah, because you have the farm on Earth. Yeah. But yeah, so you have Devrim K., you have Sloane, you have Failsafe, and then you have the weirdo dude on...
Yeah, I can't remember his name. But who has, like, a Vex arm.
Yeah, they're all great characters, and I really love Failsafe. She is a breakout character for a reason. But Sloane is really... Hawthorne is really an important part of the game.
Yeah.
So talking about the campaign structure itself, I want to come back in a little bit and talk about all the planets and all that, because there's so much cool stuff to talk about. But it's... The level design in Destiny 2 is so good. Like, I enjoyed every mission. I enjoyed every adventure. I loved how, like, I played it, like, 100%, did all the adventures before I ever moved on to the next quest. Because it just felt like you're supposed to. Like, everything feels important. You learn more about the characters. They're always really fun missions to do. But I was just constantly surprised by the ingenuity of the level design, by how fresh it all felt, that they never kept you with one group of enemies for too long. Like, it even made me realize, like, you know, one of the things that I think Destiny 1 never got enough credit for, you know, I think we talked about it back in the day, but, like, Destiny is kind of unique in that it has four full enemy sets.
Yes, it has an absurd number of different enemy types.
Yeah, and it's something that means the game can reinvent itself kind of constantly and keep you on your toes, and it's a really good part of the game. And I don't know if any one enemy set has, like, the depth of maybe... you know, the Covenant, but all overall, like, it's so much more varied than you ever get in a first-person shooter.
Oh, God, yeah.
And now, you know, we would say there's at least five, because you also have the Taken, which are a variant, but they play very differently.
Yes, they do, yeah.
And they use them here to wonderful effect. But, like, it means that as you're playing through, like, I think that they were aware on Destiny 2 of, this is a boon we have of all these enemy types, and they add a lot more in this one, in that we can constantly be coming up with new ways for you to be tackling scenarios, for no other reason than just we can throw different enemy types and configurations at you. And it's kind of, and when you have that many enemies, you can kind of make endless configurations.
Yeah. And then also you have this really great thing that they do every now and then, which is something they did in Destiny 1, but I think they leverage it better in 2. Of the one of the best things in video games is just when you have two different enemy types fighting each other in the environment. And, like, that's something that happened in Halo 1. It was something you could have in Doom, in places, in the original Doom. And it's just always fun to see that. And I love just stumbling upon, like, this massive fucking battle between, like, the Fallen and the Hive. It's just like, Jesus Christ, like, you guys have been going at it, and I'm just going to walk in here and use my super, and now you're all dead.
The world feels very alive. But on top of that, some of the, like, environments and, like, places Bungie creates for this game are such feats of imagination. They're obviously technical feats, too.
Yeah.
But, you know, the technical element will only take you so far. You have to imagine it. And the one, I want to see what your answer is for this. The one that sticks out strongest to me in Destiny 2 is the part where it's, like, the last level or the second to last one, and you are boarding the big ship that's going to blow up the sun.
Yeah.
And at a certain point, you are going outside. The sun is there. And you, no matter what, like, size TV you're playing it on, you feel like you are looking at the actual fucking sun.
Yeah.
And it will burn you alive, so you have to stay in the shadows. And you're fighting Cabal and all this stuff. And my jaw just dropped. It's like... you know, again, one, it's amazing that technically anything, you know, the PS4, Xbox One can even do this, because this is beyond anything we've ever seen. But then that they could imagine these sights and images, and that is a constant thing through Destiny 2. It's not just a beautiful game, it is a game with such creativity behind it.
Yeah.
And that goes into everything about it. But what other moments for you stand out?
Yeah, like particularly, like just sort of like from the art design side of it in particular, I think Nessus for me is so, because I always just like, I love the Vex aesthetic in Destiny and just like the weird, hard, like metal cubes and like the disappearing time stuff. And as you like go deeper and deeper into Nessus until eventually you're like, you know, you're basically at like the core of this weird like centaur, this like this asteroid kind of thing. Like, that's really cool to me. One, like, and one amazing detail in the game that I just thought was fucking awesome is you run into all the time, especially around, like, the Vex and the Taken stuff, like, weird little, like, floating pebbles and stuff that just give you a sense that you're like, oh, this is, like, space magic bullshit's happening around here. And if you go up to those pebbles and you punch them, they go flying off. Because it's like they're actually like they're in like a zero gravity field or something, and they, like, behave that way. It's a really small detail, but when, like, I was just sort of fucking around and I saw one. I was like, ah, I'm going to punch this. I punched it and actually like went flying in like a straight vector. I was like, holy shit, that's fucking awesome. I would not expect, like, I would just not expect that to happen.
Let's talk about the four spaces because I love Nessus. It's awesome. Gun to my head, it's probably my least favorite. And this is not a criticism. Yeah. It's just that I love the other three even more, because you've got Io, which was the one that kind of blew me away the most, because it's
really good, yeah.
It's really different than anything else in Destiny 1 or 2. And it's got just like these, you know, these cascading like sand things going on, and these,
and like
purplish
all these
colors.
Yeah, the fossils I think are really cool.
It just looks really fucking cool. Like, yeah. I would probably concede that Nessus is more interesting in terms of its design. There's just something about the look of Io I love.
Yeah,
Titan blew me away because you're on this like big like rig, and there's just this water, and the skyboxes there are just Bungie showing off, because you've got these basically these big ships just like cascading in the water, and that's amazing.
And then I love the one thing I love in Titan is when you go into the like big arboreum sort of area that's like, because it's like this colony or whatever that is totally empty, and going into there and seeing like the ruins of, you know, that great sort of like golden age human civilization was really cool.
It's really neat. Yeah. And then the European Dead Zone is so awesome.
Yeah.
It's for those who don't know, like we've like kind of known about the European Dead Zone forever, because it was actually planned for like vanilla Destiny. It was one of their original plans. So they've had it in the works, and they were going to introduce it at several points and kept holding off. And finally we get it here, and it's just, it's very cool. It's recognizably the Earth of Destiny. But, like, I think it being Europe and having, like, churches and things, like, the church you go meet Devrim Kay in is so cool. It's so much fun. It feels the most like one of the Destiny 1 spaces to me, but it's all of it. They're all good, though. Like, there's not a clunker in the bunch. And I loved all the main spaces in Destiny 1, but you could very much point to, like, Mars, they never did much with.
Right,
you know?
Yeah.
Or Venus is actually really annoying in how it's laid out if you want to get anywhere.
Uh-huh.
I don't have any of those issues with Destiny 2. I think these are, it is quality over quantity. You know, they don't have a ton of spaces, but boy are they good.
Yeah, and in, like, and going back to like the visual side of it as well for the European Dead Zone, when you go to like the dark, like haunted forest kind of area, whenever, like for that an early story mission, and then whenever you get a new subclass, you have to go back there and visit the Shard of the Traveler.
That's the coolest.
That's so fucking awesome. And just like the Shard of the Traveler itself looks so cool. And like that visual for me is really striking. And like everything they do with the Traveler in this game, when you get to the end of it and you have like the Traveler reawakens and stuff, I think they capture the sense of majesty and like mystery of that thing way better in Destiny 2 than they ever did in Destiny 1. That it was always just kind of there in Destiny 1.
Yeah.
And it feels way more present in Destiny 2.
Well, let's talk about the graphics, because they are out of this world. I mean, I was expecting a step up. You know, we'd seen it a little bit in Rise of Iron.
Yeah.
I was still blown away by this. And I also was worried, like, because I played, like, 30 minutes of it on PC. I was like, is that going to ruin the Xbox version for me? Nope. It's amazing. It is consistently jaw-dropping. It is a pain in the ass to take screenshots on the Xbox One, but I took a ton of screenshots because it just looks that amazing. I did a lot in the Dark Forest where I would look up at the sky with like its northern lights and the way there's like those inky trees that bisect it. It's amazing. But I was constantly just looking out at vistas. This is visually the best work Bungie has ever done.
Yeah.
And it feels like, you know, we recently did that Let's Play playing through Halo 1. You can see it now on YouTube.
Yeah.
But we constantly kind of stopped and looked at the skyboxes and things like that. And you can draw, for me, you can draw such a clear line between like that and now Destiny 2. And it's there. The imagination has always been there. Now they just have the technical side to do something way bigger than they ever could have thought of back in 2001. And some of the things you see in this game are so utterly beautiful. And it's another thing I like, I think, very much about the campaign is that it brings you to those places and allows you to look at it and feel that wonder and really feel what it's like to be a guardian, you know, going and exploring the universe. But just the graphics, there's so much color in them. There's so much depth to the image. They've added, like, and this was, I don't think this was in the beta, a slight grain effect, like in Mass Effect or Mass Effect 2, which I really love when it's done well. Like, Mass Effect 2 does it really well, where it just gives the image just enough texture that everything looks a little better to me. But it doesn't slow the game down or anything. It runs very solidly.
Yeah.
And this is another game that I just look at, and it's like, okay, yeah, the 4K stuff is cool, 60 FPS, but I'm okay with my 1080p TV because this looks really good.
Yeah, it is just, it's one of those things of where their tech, like, there's obviously, like, a lot of really great tech work going on there, but it all feels like it's in service of really, like, just a beautiful art design.
Yeah.
And this incredible aesthetic, this incredible, like, sense of, like, science fiction aesthetic that is so rich and detailed and textured that, that all that, like, you know, all the horsepower and the tech they're putting behind the game is aimed in the right direction, and it doesn't feel like some games that, you know, end up like using like really great sort of like, you know, tech cred to then push a very bland art design or like just be like, oh, it looks really realistic, but you're not actually doing anything with it. And here it's like, no, like this is all, you know, in service of, you know, putting you inside the core of a planet or right outside the fucking giant sun or seeing a like huge, you know, like fallen catch ship fly in, and every time that happens in a public event or something like that is awesome, or finding like a giant servitor. There's just so much incredible art design there that all the visual design is in the right place.
It's really amazing. And, you know, the art direction was no slouch in Destiny 1. I think at the time I said I thought Destiny 1 was the best-looking game on the new consoles when that first came out. And I think at the time I would probably stand by that. It was a beautiful-looking game because the art direction was so good. But you see what I think, you know, 3 more years spent in this universe, a more confident vision, better, you know, they don't have to work with the PS3 and Xbox 360, so they have better technical stuff behind them. All of that just makes an image and a visual aesthetic that is more energized, more creative, and just all-around jaw-dropping.
Yeah.
So, the other thing worth mentioning in all of this is the music.
Yes, yeah.
It's out of this world. I mean, this is already such a historically great year for video game music, but I was not expecting Destiny 2 to blow me away like this. And honestly, I think what it is that Martin O'Donnell has been gone long enough that they're not in his shadow, and the team at Bungie, they're just doing their own thing. They are not trying to imitate Martin O'Donnell. They're not even imitating the Destiny 1 score. It's a very different score this time.
Yeah, there's like a couple of times that in some of the bigger themes, they sort of like echo the original Destiny theme, but generally, it's just completely original music.
And I think it's, honestly, to me, it is the most striking thing about the game, like, immediately and throughout, is just the music is so gorgeous. It's not the kind of music that usually accompanies this kind of game. It's a lot softer a lot of the time and less aggressive than you get in this kind of thing, which Martin O'Donnell kind of pioneered and is very, very good at. But, you know, he's not there anymore, and I'm glad that Michael Salvatore and Sky Paul Johnson and all these guys, like, really went in their own direction and did their own thing with it, because it's a really unique score, and it works great in the big, you know, adrenaline, you know, pumping moments, but it also just, when you're on the farm and you go back there's just this rush of emotion every time, and it's a huge part of what makes this game work.
Yeah, because there's also, there's a really different musical quality to the different planets as well, and there's like a nice, like, it's particularly like all the music on Io is very beautiful, and then like on Titan you get that, like, I think they use it a little bit on Nessus as well, this like power guitar that comes in every now and then that's really distorted, that almost has like a Doom 2016 feel to it, and just like, you're like, oh yeah, fuck it, yeah, that was awesome. But then for me, like, the standout part of the score is that, like, the new big theme that is, like, particularly, it's most featured in that section where, you know, you fall off the tower and have to climb back up, and it's that kind of, like, time-dilated sequence of it cuts every now and then, and it's this beautiful string piece.
That
is the core of the new soundtrack, that then it comes up every now and again, and, like, the farm theme has it in places. And then particularly once you get to the end of the game and it starts coming back up again, but in this far more like triumphant way, I found like that theme is really powerful.
Yeah. And, you know, so putting all this together, when I say that like the campaign and your first run through the game, it's all so fucking good.
Yeah.
That there is just a slight letdown for me when it opens up. And there's a lot of fun stuff to do, and I've enjoyed all of that. But some of that is like, it's a very good, more polished version of the Destiny 1 grind. It's still kind of the grind to me.
Sure.
And I do miss a little bit the propulsion of the campaign. But, you know, I think ultimately I will spin that as they just did such a good job on that part of it that was not something I was even necessarily looking forward to in Destiny 2. Right. I thought it would have a nice little campaign like the Taken King or something. I was not expecting that.
Yeah.
It's great.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Like, all the mission design is fantastic. It's so, so much better than Destiny 1, which just had the walk up to a thing, hold down square, have your ghost scan a thing, and fight off three waves of enemies. Like, that was such the, like, core design of 90% of the Destiny 1 missions. And here, you are so far from that. Of every single mission has a different sort of core design tenet, and has a very different feel, and you're moving through fighting different kinds of enemies in different sort of scenarios. Has a much more sort of propulsive cinematic feel to it than Destiny 1 did.
One of the things that's nice about the adventures, the things you do on the planets, and like, at first they kind of seem like they're in lieu of patrols, but later you do get the traditional patrols too, is those do allow you sometimes to do the thing of you put the ghost up and then fight off waves of enemies. And yeah, those are good in small doses, right? Yeah. Like, sometimes when you just have kind of a, you know, horde mode kind of thing in Destiny, those can be really good challenges. In Destiny 1, it's just that was the whole game.
Yeah.
So here they know when to use that and when not, and the moments not to use that are your big story scenes, you know, yeah, like your big campaign missions.
And the thing that gets me about it is that with those adventures, which are, like, basically side quests that are in the game that you get on each planet, is that those are, they did feel to me like, this is basically like Destiny 1 missions in Destiny 2, because they also, you know, they all take place in those maps and are reusing those environments, whereas a lot of the Destiny 2 missions, you're going to, like, unique locations, like on that ship and stuff like that. But the adventures take you all throughout the sort of big patrol zones in different areas in there. But I think also there tends to be more creativity in the mission design in the adventures than even
I agree.
Of like, one of my favorite ones is the one on Titan where you have to go chase down all these fallen guys that have stolen different equipment and stuff. And Ghost is constantly like, no, that one is definitely the thief. I can tell that one's the thief.
Yeah.
Like there's a way more memorable little bits of writing and character development and unique mission objectives in the adventures even than there were in Destiny 1, which is a credit to how fun those are.
Yeah, it's hilarious because, you know, there's no real way to play exactly vanilla Destiny 1 anymore. But if you could sit, I mean, some of the basics are there. You still have, I guess, the missions. But if you were to sit someone down at a computer after they'd played Destiny 2, I guess not a computer, but, you know, at a games console, after playing Destiny 2, and you could magically play day one vanilla Destiny and have them play that, what would their reaction be?
God, yeah.
Be like, boy, they came a long way.
Uh-huh.
And it's insane. And it's a weird thing, because this is one of the rare things where we've really been on the ground floor of this journey to now, because we both played the alpha and everything.
Right, yeah.
And it's been a crazy, crazy saga to get here.
Yes, but it's so satisfying to be here.
Yeah. So let's talk about, you beat the game.
Yes.
And you have the tower now, which is cool. It's the music there isn't as good as the farm, but it's very good. It's a very rousing piece of music. Feels appropriate to that moment in the game.
The tower overlooks, like, the destroyed, well, not totally destroyed, but this, like, fucked up version of the Traveler that I really like.
It's really cool.
Yeah.
And it's a little overwhelming at first, but then you realize, like, okay, I see the new rhythm, because now you have, like, a certain number of characters, they all control some part of the end game. Like, Zavala is the strikes.
Yeah.
And Ikora is where you can replay campaign missions. It's kind of like a replacement of the heroics.
Yeah.
And then you have, you know, the Shax, who's always done the Crucible. And, boy, Shax got really cool in this game.
Yeah, I love every time I got to go up to Shax and get some new dialogue from him. Because you love, particularly the scene at the beginning of the game when he's in the farm. And he's like, you know what, like, I know everything's destroyed, but I have the Crucible up and running again because I think we need it now more than ever. And like, you know what, Shax, you're really wrong about that, but goddammit, you're so lovable, sure. Like, I don't know why you've constructed a death pit for all the Guardians that are now mortal for right now. It's maybe not the best idea, but man, you sure are passionate about your fucking Crucible, aren't you?
Well, it's funny because I remember back in like the Alpha and the Beta and the beginning of Vanilla Destiny, I thought like this voice in Crucible who I did not connect to a character was kind of boring, but he got better and better over Destiny 1. And now, like, honestly, Shax is one of my very favorite things about Destiny 2, about Destiny in general. Yeah. And I love playing Crucible and hearing from Shax. And I'm still hearing new things. There was my brother, he recorded this because I didn't quite believe him when he said this happened. But So it's what happened was his super was almost out and his health was almost out, and someone else came up at him with his super. And so Thomas was able to use his super and kill the other guy even though he was almost dead. And so he lived through it all, and Shax just in the background goes, "Yes!" If you can find that online, it is an amazing voice clip.
Yeah.
I also didn't know, Shax is Lenny James from The Walking Dead.
Huh.
That's a weird connection.
Sure.
Because that guy, I don't watch The Walking Dead, but like I've seen clips and stuff, and like as most characters on The Walking Dead are, he's kind of sad, and you know, I guess sad. That's all I get from that show. Is that they're all sad.
This is a zombie apocalypse.
Yeah,
you have a right to be sad.
I don't think he gets to go like yes.
Yeah.
So anyway, I love that he's doing that, and again, he's another actor who was there from day one and has just gotten better and better with the role. So yeah, we have Shax with the Crucible stuff. Hawthorne covers the clan stuff, which they've really improved in this game.
Yeah.
You get a lot. If you should be part of a clan if you're not, because you get a ton of XP rewards and stuff. It's cool. And you have the Gunsmith where you go through that. But like the campaign, it's something worth talking about. The structure of like all the different, you know, people you go and talk to is that there are a lot of them, but because the campaign doles it out in a good order and then you open it up at the end and you get your feet under you, you really know all the time where everything goes, what it all goes towards, and how all of the different cycles work together. And I don't think it makes for the richest endgame possible. I do think there's some gaps where I feel like I was wish there was some more here and here, and there's some things with the strikes I'd want to talk about. But I do really like, and this is something they can build on very well, that I know where everything goes, and I know how to get my level up, basically, which I did not know in Vanilla Destiny.
Yeah, I think one of the smartest things they've done is that no matter what you do, everything you do once you get to that in-game point, whether it's you're going and doing public events, you're doing challenges on the different planets, you're running patrols, you're doing Crucible, you're running strikes, you're doing old missions, no matter what it is you're doing, you're running the raid, you're doing the Nightfall, anything. Everything is about filtering down to you getting new gear, and that's it. But from that point, once you get legendary gear, you can dismantle that, and that's where you get the legendary marks from, and that's where that comes from. But everything is just about getting new gear, and that's it. That's what everything filters into. There's no strange coins. There's no motes of light. There's no weird, like, random other bits of, like, strange currencies and reputations and like everything is like you turn in these things to this person and that gets you a like engram that gets you new gear. You like do the Crucible quests and that gets you new gear. You run the strike that gets you new gear. You do the public event that gets you new gear. You go into the lost sectors and you get to the end of that gets you new gear. Like all of that gets you new gear, which you can then some of it dismantle to buy more gear with your legendary marks.
Here's a good example. In Destiny 1, every planet had a different element that you could mine, and in the vanilla version of Destiny 1, that's like all you did at a certain point because you needed that to upgrade your gear.
Right.
Remember?
Yeah.
So like, I remember going around the moon, I remember vividly sitting on our couch in my apartment listening to the podcasts and running around the moon and farming the fucking light shit, whatever it was.
Yeah, like helium filaments.
Helium filaments on the moon.
Yeah, I did. I have a very vivid, kind of similar memory, but for me it was getting spin metal on Earth while I was listening to the soundtrack from the anime Welcome to the NHK. Nice. It was a very good soundtrack and made that process much more tolerable.
Yes, but that was like so much of Destiny 1. And I remember there was a point in Destiny 2 when I saw, oh, there's something on this planet. It's like the data mine fragment or whatever it is. It's like, God damn it, did they do this again? These fuckers. And then I started going, like, getting some of it and realizing, like, oh, these just become, like, pieces for your affinity with this character.
Yeah.
Which gets you more gear. So again, you immediately and instinctually understand the purpose of everything you're doing. There's no fat in all of that.
Yeah. Everything you get just filters into one thing. Like, no matter how weird it is, no matter, like it's alkaline dust or whatever on fucking Nessus or whatever shit, or I think that's on Io. Like, wherever you are and whatever you're picking up, you, like, you know, you're getting all these weird tokens that you get from doing public events or whatever on some of the planets. You just turn those into those people that, like, once you get 10 of them, it'll just put a mark on where they are so you know to go there and turn it in. And once you get in, turn in enough of them, you get another piece of gear. And the same way with the gunsmith. I will love how they've sort of, like, taken that idea of, like, the materials. That was also something in Destiny 1 that you need to just, like, get materials by dismantling guns and armor. And then you'd spend them to try to upgrade that armor. And instead, you get that those materials from dismantling equipment in Destiny 2, but all that does is you then turn that shit into the gunsmith dude, and then he will, and once you get enough of it, he will give you an engram. So it's like you are, no matter what you're doing in Destiny, you're always progressing towards your ultimate goal of getting better gear to increase your power level, to become more powerful and get more interesting exotics and stuff like that. Everything you do in a very simple way filters down to that, which is so much better than even, like, you know, having to deal with having legendary marks and crucible marks, and you got legendary marks by running all different weird kinds of things all over the place. All the only way you get legendary marks, and there's only that one currency, is just by dismantling legendary gear, and that's all you need. And it's like, that's such a more direct, intuitive way of approaching that. I love it so much better than what Destiny 1 had to do.
It's a huge improvement, and it means that, you know, it also means that however you want to play the end game, it kind of accommodates that.
Exactly.
In a good way. If we want to get into, like, criticisms, I would say, like, because it all filters down that single-mindedly, it does get repetitive fast to me. And I do get to the point where, like, right, I'm constantly getting gear. And, like, the grind of there's, you know, there are different caps of what level you're going to get with the gear.
Right.
And there does get a point where, like, okay, it's been 2 days since I got literally anything usable. And I just, you know, I get, like, all this gear every day, and I'm just constantly dismantling. And it can kind of get a little grindy and feel a little dull to me. But at the same time, what I do like about it is it's clearly such a good foundation. And this is, we're in, you know, week two of Destiny 2. Yeah. The prospects for what they could build on top of all of that, and I do think they need to add some more stuff here and there, but what they can build on top of that is really exciting, and what's there now, again, if you don't, like, force yourself to overplay it, which I think is a real danger, you can have a lot of fun with it kind of however you want to. And, you know, they give you the milestones and the challenges to do each day. I wish there were a few more milestones or a little more complex ones, because there have been some days where, like, I'll do one milestone quickly, and then the only other two are the Nightfall and the Raid, and it's like, well, I don't really have the capacity to do that right now, right. So I kind of did the main things in the game today, and I wish there was a couple more little things to go in and do. But, yeah, no, I do think, especially if we're talking about this and remembering that this game is in its early stages, and what that endgame is going to become is going, hopefully, to transform a lot over the months to come, this is a great foundation for that.
Yeah, absolutely, because it is something of, like, one of the nice things is that even if you're getting gear that you're not using, you are getting that legendary currency.
Sure, yeah.
That then you can, once Xur comes in, you can go buy new exotics from him. That, to me, that's always been, like, the thing about Destiny is just, like, I just want to get all the exotics. I just want to have all this shit. Like, even if they're ones I don't like using. Because I did get, because I'm playing as a hunter, and I did get a piece of exotic gear relatively quickly after I beat the campaign. That is these legs that modify your Night Stalker subclass, that makes it so that basically when you use the super for that, where you shoot out an arrow that then tethers two enemies in the environment and kind of connects them together. So if you hit one enemy that's tethered, it damages all the other enemies that are tethered, which is the same as that super from Destiny 1, because that was the Taken King class for the Hunter. And I love that super, and I love that class is in the game still, because it's very fun to play. But the piece of exotic equipment I got makes it so that when you use that super, you recharge your super to the number of different enemies you've tethered with it, to the point where if you use it in a huge group of enemies, you basically just get three supers. To the point where there were some points when I was running a strike where I had like three different of those like black hole supers out at the same time, because there were so many enemies on screen that I just had them tethered constantly. And it's such an amazing feeling. That I think that is still something that like Destiny 2 has got, that when you find that thing of like whatever that gun is, whatever that piece of equipment is, you're like, oh shit. Because I was just using the Arc Strider class the whole time through the campaign, and then I got that piece of gear, I was like, oh, I'll play the Night Stalker thing. This is a fucking amazing way to play this game.
That's awesome. And yeah, one of my favorite things about all the gear, and I think there's a ton of really cool gear, and then that one unfortunate piece of racist gear, but I think that was an honest mistake.
Yeah.
Good on them for, we're joking about it, good on Bungie for actually, you know, taking all that into being adults about it.
Yeah.
Which a lot of people aren't these days.
Right, yeah.
Anyway, so it's up to the game companies to be adults. Anyway, I think all the gear in this game, there's so much cool stuff, and the one downside is that I got the gear I liked best very early in the end game, and I am not going to change it because it looks so fucking cool.
Uh-huh.
Because I have just the coolest armor, and I got the right kind of shaders, and it's all shaded the same, where I'm a very like blue and purple like Titan lady, and it's cool. But my helmet is like an old-fashioned like medieval knight helmet, which looks really cool. Like it looks like the kind of thing where you pull it down, it's got like the three slits in it. It looks like, you know, like something from Monty Python and the Holy Grail, sure. But cooler, and I love that. And then my chest piece specifically is this amazing Titan chest piece where the whole stomach is just this open flame. Like it's a bunch of, I don't know if you saw the picture I posted, but it's these moving flames where it looks like there's a like fire pit in your stomach and it's just burning and it looks awesome. And you're supposed to use it with my favorite class, which is also from The Taken King, which is the Sunbreaker, where you have the big flaming Thor hammers. So that looks awesome. And there's a Titan insignia on the middle. And again, I got it all shaded. So like my Titan looks exactly how I want her to. So now I'm just like getting, you know, other armor to infuse for points. But I like that it lets you do that. Like it doesn't force you to use things you don't want to use.
Yeah, and like infusing is so much more straightforward a process. Yes. That even that, because even that was like a late addition to Destiny 1, relatively speaking. Yeah. And even then, when it was a late addition, it was full of bullshit where like, if you infused a piece of gear just trying to, like, because basically that is like you consume one piece of gear to increase the level of the piece of gear you actually want to the level that that other piece of gear that you fed it to was. And so, but in Destiny 1, when you did that, you didn't get it up to that level. So if, like, you had a piece of gear that was, like, 230 and you had another one that was, like, 250 and you wanted that, you did it, and then, but then it came out and it was 248 because you couldn't get the exact value. It's like, fuck off. Like, come on. Because that especially made it very hard to then get something at, like, the highest level once you're at, like, the end of the end game. And in Destiny 2, it's just like, no. You just get... It is... If it's 230 and you have it, and you have a 250 thing, you just get 250.
Yeah.
And it's just as powerful as that. And it's like, awesome. Great. That's how it should work. It only costs some glimmer and some red legendary shards. There's no weird, like, exotic... prism, like all this other shit that it consumes. It's like, no. It just takes a couple of legendary marks and some glimmer, and that's it.
You know, I want to talk about the weapons in a second, but just while I'm on it, like, you talking about all that, this game really reminds me in so many ways of Diablo 3.
Yeah.
Like,
exactly.
It's worth time. And Diablo 3 is a little more complicated in a lot of ways because it's the third Diablo. It's a long-running franchise. They have that. But it does feel like, at least the version of Diablo 3 I've played, which is the Reaper of Souls console edition, like, it just feels, like, confident and streamlined, and even if, again, Diablo 3 is a little more complex, but once you played enough, you know where everything goes, you know how the grind works, and it just feels, like, very streamlined and very confident in itself, and I love that about Diablo 3. This game, it feels like a Bungie game to me, but it has that kind of Blizzard polish to it.
Sure.
In ways that you can, you know, I would not be surprised if they had a few more meetings with people from Blizzard just for inspiration, because it's got that kind of, as I said, the polish and the smoothness to it.
Yeah.
But yeah. Talking about the weapons, though. Yeah. I did get my favorite exotic, which is the Mida Multitool, which is my favorite weapon.
Okay, I haven't gotten that one yet.
Yeah, it's one of the exotic quests you get after beating the game, which is great. And that was always my favorite weapon in Destiny 1, so I'm glad they had it in here. And it's just as good as ever. Love it. But so I got that. I've got some other cool weapons. The one thing that I'm still looking for is my favorite weapon I have gotten in the game, though, in Destiny 2, is I'm not actually that big on the new weapon types they've introduced. I like the submachine guns okay. But other than that, like, what did they have? The grenade launcher. I don't like that. And what's the other one they added?
Those are
the two.
Jeez. There's the...
Maybe that's the only two.
Submachine gun. Because it's one thing they have done is that they've added, like sidearms have a bunch of different kinds.
Right.
And, like,
well,
there are a bunch of different kinds of swords that they
added.
And
here's what I was going to get to. My favorite kind of weapon in the game is there's a sidearm class that does 3-round bursts and is very accurate. It's a great gun. It's my favorite thing. But the most powerful version of that I've gotten is still a blue at level 220.
Oh, I have like a level 250 or 260 purple one of those that I still have. I pull out every now and then.
See, and I would be using it constantly because I love that sidearm to death. And in Crucible, I always use it because it's super useful there. And you know, when you're in Crucible, your level doesn't count.
Yeah.
So it's great. So I still keep it around. But like, I love that gun so much. And I'm still out through the galaxy on a hunt for a better version of that gun. But I love that that's part of it. Like, there's a lot of guns in Destiny 2, and I think you could make the argument they should at some point start paring them down. Like, I really don't see the point of hand cannons at this point, but whatever.
Hand cannons are fucking awesome. You're crazy. They're so good. The problem is you're not playing as a hunter, because they added in the ability to do the dodge roll that you can have. So when you do the dodge roll, it reloads your gun. And the fucking hand cannons, that is awesome.
Okay, that's awesome, because that's one of the problems with hand cannons if you're not a hunter,
yeah.
is that they take forever to reload and shoot really slow. So,
yes, but if you are accurate with them...
No, and ooh, I just got an exotic hand cannon at 290, so it's insanely powerful. It's actually higher than 290 because I was able to put a mod on it. But like, so maybe I'll have to start a hunter and just give him that gun, because that's the thing, I'm also getting enough gear that like I really want to start an alt so I can like put some of that onto the other character and start exploring that, because... Also kind of a thing that reminds me of Diablo 3 is that the classes are all distinct and cool enough now that I really want to play as all of them.
Yeah.
Like, and I'm really excited for the point when Destiny like is old enough and confident enough that they can add the fourth class or something.
Sure.
Because that's going to come at some point, obviously, yeah. And I'm excited to see what they do with it. But yeah, no, overall, though, what I was saying is just that there's so many types of guns, you inevitably develop favorites and whatnot, and it does give you a lot of tracks to go find more favorites, and I like that.
Yeah. And I also just really like, because this is something we talked about with the beta, of how they have retooled the weapon system.
That's so smart.
It's so smart. And I think one thing they did that was really good is they have increased the amount of purple ammo you get even from what the beta had, which is already more than you got in Destiny 1.
Yeah.
So, like, I feel like I'm able to use my power weapon basically as frequently as I used my special weapon in Destiny 1, which is, like, the right balance now. Mm-hmm. Instead of having, like, one weapon you use all the time with, like, a secondary weapon that you use somewhat frequently, and then a third weapon that you almost never use, which is what Destiny 1 was like, you have one weapon that you use more often, another weapon that you use pretty frequently, and then a third weapon that you use, like, fairly, not as frequently, but fairly frequently in special circumstances.
Yeah.
And then your, like, thing that you use every once in a while is your super instead. And, like, that, I think, attack balance is much better. And I love getting that sense of, like, you know, particularly as you're playing through the campaign, as you're just getting new guns all the time, you're forced to adjust your playstyle to whatever is your most powerful, like, set of weapons you have at any given moment. So it forces you to try out, like, okay, like, let's see what it's like having a hand cannon and a submachine gun and a sniper rifle, and see, like, how does that adjust? How do I play to adjust to that?
Yep.
What, like, how does that change what I do here? And I definitely, and you do get end up getting to a place where now in Destiny 2, I'm at a place where I'm like, I have a very specific kind of scout rifle I like with my sidearm I like that could also be a submachine gun, and then whatever my special weapon, like I could take a shotgun. I really like having shotguns.
I usually have a shotgun.
But like I could take a sniper rifle there, I could take a sword there. But like that, I really like having that, like a scout rifle and then like a pistol or a submachine gun that's really good for close range, that split for my two weapons.
You and I think the same. That's generally what I have too, if I have the right ones. And it's another thing I actually really loved about the campaign is that you're constantly getting new stuff and experimenting with that.
Yeah.
And again, it's just something that we talked about this in the beta, the new way they've configured weapons allows for you to experiment and personalize a lot more.
Yeah.
Because, you know, that's the other thing is that your secondary weapon slot, it's secondary, but you can use them roughly as much as you want.
Yeah, because you get the energy weapon and the kinetic weapon ammo types really quickly.
Yeah, so like if you have your preferred weapon just happens to be an energy one, you can use it. That's like that doesn't stop you.
Yeah.
And it's a really like there were definitely stretches of the campaign where the best gun I had was in that second slot. And at some points it just felt like Halo where you just have two weapon slots.
Yeah.
You know, and it's all very, very smart. Like all the changes they've made, pretty much everything is an improvement.
Yeah.
So let's talk about two parts of the endgame, which is Strikes and Crucible.
Right.
And I have interesting thoughts on both of them, which is I started out thinking like, oh, these Strikes are really cool. I'm really liking this. And I was start out thinking, I think they've made some changes to Crucible that I don't like. And I've now flipped that. I'm not that hot on the Strikes. I'm very much enjoying Crucible.
Yeah, for me, like I haven't played as much of the Strikes in Crucible as I would have liked because I've been busy with other stuff. And with the Strikes, I really enjoy the Strikes. I think the problem is, like, they need to put a bigger reward system for them because they're a very big commitment compared to doing, like, running public events. But you get kind of the same amount of rewards out of them. And, like, public events you can do very quickly. I love public events in Destiny 2. Like, what they have done with those are so smart and really fun to do. But you get so much good stuff out of doing that, and you can do it so relatively quickly that, like, the Strikes are such a bigger time commitment, but you get basically the same, like, quantity of reward out of both of them. And that doesn't feel balanced.
It's a weird part where the Strikes in some way feel like an afterthought, because I will, like, yeah, I will play the Strikes sometimes, but I much more prefer going down to a planet, doing patrols, hitting public events, doing some challenges, that kind of thing. And the Strikes, like, some of the Strikes I think are pretty good. Overall, it's one part that I would say I don't think is as good as Destiny 1. I don't think the Strike design is as good. I think there are some that are on the same level, like the one that was in the beta, I would put with the best from Destiny 1. But the difference is, I always thought the Strikes were the best part of Destiny 1, and I enjoyed them so much. And in Destiny 2, some of them I like, some of them I find kind of a little too long and a little too rote. And again, as you say, with the reward system, it's something that I don't feel. And the other problem is that Destiny 1 had this issue, but it was with a Strike I really liked. Destiny 2, every time I go into the playlist, I get the same fucking Strike. Huh. Every single time I get, and I might get other ones after it, but I will always get, at least once, the one on Nessus in the Exodus Black where you have to go kill the invisible guy, and I don't think it's a very good strike. I think it's annoying, and I don't know.
I don't think I've gotten that one yet.
Oh, God, I've done it at least like 10 times. Like, it's amazing how many times I've gotten that one, and I find it so annoying. But, like, and it's funny because I got a Vex one on Destiny 1 a lot because it was the Nexus Mind one you got time on Destiny 1. But, like, I liked that strike a lot, and I thought it's a pretty good one. This one, I'm always getting that one, so it's already, like, de-incentivized me because maybe it's just luck, but whatever. I'm getting it constantly. So I don't know if I've even seen all the strikes yet, but the ones I have seen, the other ones I generally like. But most of them, like, just don't even stick in my memory. That one that I've played a bunch, and then the one on Earth that was in the beta. No, not that it wasn't on Earth. The other one on Nessus from the beta, which I think is very good. The other ones I just don't find as memorable. They feel a little, as I said, just kind of rote. Like, you know, go here, kill these enemies. Go here, kill these enemies. Big enemy, you know, bullet sponge. The end.
I mean, that's what the strikes in Destiny 1 were.
Sure, but I thought they found... But you can always find more creative ways to disguise your basic structure.
Sure.
And I just thought, like, you know, I still think kind of weirdly the gold standard of strikes in Destiny 1 is the very first one from, like, the beta and stuff.
The Sepix Prime one.
The Sepix Prime one, which I think is a really good example of how to do that well. And it has some... It's just you go to a lot of places and you see a lot of cool stuff. And I think there's some good challenge there.
My problem with the Sepix Prime one was always, like, that the Fallen Walker fight in that... strike was so different depending on what group you got.
That's very true.
If people did not know how to fight that fight, it would just take fucking an hour. Or if people knew how to fight that fight, it was like, this is over in like 3 minutes.
Right. But I don't think I've found one that like sticks in my memory so far as much as like the best strikes in, which were in vanilla Destiny, the strikes were really good. Like that's one thing that I think was unambiguously pretty good about Destiny 1. So anyway, that's kind of my issue. Crucible is a weird thing where I had a journey with it where at first... And I still think to a certain degree, I think they've simplified Crucible just a twinge too much. Like, there's only two playlists. There's quick play and there's competitive. Right. And, you know, I do like having hoppers because maybe I don't want to play Clash or maybe I don't want to play this. But overall, I've learned, like, how many of the game types there are and I've learned to enjoy the different ones. And I think it actually makes sense once you get into the grind of it because the way they have the challenge structure, it actually really helps going through multiple ones because the way... Like, each one might help you get a different challenge in a different way. So that's nice. And competitive has a different set of challenges than quick play. I also think that... I think it's part of it is people have gotten better at playing Crucible. But in the first couple days, I thought the matches felt so slow. Because it was all 4v4. But some of the maps felt a little too big for me for 4v4. And there's one in particular that's way too big for 4v4. And it's one where you can, like... go through this big cannon and go on to another part of the map. And it's just, it's like, that's an 8v8 map or something.
Yeah, I only played that one on control, and I thought that worked really well for control. Because you can, like, it's a big map, but you can traverse it so quickly with the...
But on any thing fights. That's like a more deathmatch kind of thing, it's really problematic. Because a lot of matches you just time out and you don't even get near
the score. That was the most fun I've had in... Probably actually most fun I've had in Crucible in all of Destiny was I had a controlled match on that map.
Okay.
That felt like, this is so much better than Crucible has ever been to me in Destiny.
But that might be why hoppers of different types might be a good thing. Because I don't know if that's a map for everything. But I just want to say, like, for whatever reason, the more I've played Crucible... Because I've always liked Crucible in Destiny. It's something I think I've always... We've talked about that. I've liked it more than you. But overall, I think for whatever reason, I've gotten into the groove of it more. The maps feel better. I think people know them better. So it doesn't feel like you're all just running in circles looking for each other. And it's gotten into a really good mode. And some of that, I think, is that I really like how they implement challenges in Destiny 2, where it's not you go pick them up from someone.
Yeah.
They're just there for you. And you look up at them and you're like, okay, I'm going to play it this way and figure out how to do this. And overall, like, Crucible's been a really fun thing to jump into and has honestly probably replaced... in my general, like, grind of Destiny, where I would play strikes, is now I spend a lot of that time in Crucible. And I'm actually fine with that, because I like Crucible. I think the modes they've chosen are really good. They brought back Supremacy, which was one they introduced very late in Destiny 1, that's basically kill confirmed from Call of Duty.
Yeah.
And that one's really good, and it works really well with the 4v4 on Destiny 2. I like being able to use my different weapons. I would like to see them expanded a little bit. As with everything in the Destiny 2 endgame, it feels a little sparse, but... it's a foundation, and it's a really good one, and it's one part of the game I'm enjoying a lot right now.
I mean, the end game of every video game that has an end game always feels sparse when it launches. Like, there's just never been, in my experience, a situation where you get to the end game of a game and you're like, oh yeah, this is as fully featured as it needs to be. Because
it's just worth noting for now. Yeah.
Because for me, with Crucible, it's something that I like. I really liked Crucible in the alpha and beta of Destiny 1 because nobody knew how to play that game yet, and the like equipment was so reined in that I felt like, oh, this is like a pretty fun, interesting, different kind of multiplayer. In full Destiny, it was always a situation of like, it's just utter fucking chaos. Like, there's no way to get your head around a match, no way to wrangle a match under control, because there are so many insane variables of different weapon types that people can be using with like different exotics, and everyone has their fucking supers, and it's all bullshit, and it was like really hard to get a sense of a flow of a match in Destiny 1 and Crucible, because it was also, you know, it had like fucking 12 people in a match. It was ridiculous. In Destiny 2, like, I would like them to, and I think they probably will, like, eventually add more modes that have like, you know, big team modes and stuff like that in different playlists. But I haven't played that much Crucible, but what I have played, I've enjoyed so much more of that. It is a much more focused 4v4 kind of mode. Supers are there, but I think the supers are balanced in a way that they feel much more approachable.
Balance is the key word here.
Yeah, Dave. That it's like you're not just getting hit by fucking Nova bombs out of nowhere constantly and just all like kinds of random bullshit. I think like the way they have changed the weapon structure has also helped a lot of that, like, you know, the kinetic and energy weapon and then your power weapon. That has helped a lot, and I think it's more fun coming up with different configurations of weapons for Crucible that way, because you're more frequently using both of your weapons and then like occasionally getting to use your power weapon.
This is a multiplayer FPS where a sniper rifle is not something you can use all the time.
Exactly.
It's a nice thing.
And it's just something, I think the maps flow much better, and there's just a much clearer sense of balance and control and flow to a match that I feel like I know my place in this match, I understand how well I'm doing, and I understand what I need to do better. And that's like the basic thing I want from a competitive multiplayer game, and that's something I felt like I never had a sense of that in Destiny 1 Crucible, and here I just think I've had such a better time with it.
Well, here's how I'll define it, because I played a lot of Crucible in Destiny 1, but I did have issues with it, and one of those issues was so often, like most of the time in Destiny 1, it was a ringer in some way or another. Like, right. you either won by a lot or you lost by a lot, and it was very rare to have close matches. At this point now, I've played almost 2 weeks of Destiny 2. I've played a lot of Crucible. And the more I play and the better people get, it's not going more towards the routes. It's actually going more towards the center. And I have had so many close matches in Destiny 2. And it's exhilarating.
Yeah.
It's really cool. And it just speaks to all the little improvements they've made.
Yeah. In Destiny 1 and Crucible, did they have the thing that Destiny 2 has, that at the top of the screen you can see what all the subclasses are and
nope.
if you have supers powered up?
That's new.
That is so huge to me. Because
yep.
I thought that was something that might have been something they had added in Destiny 1 I never knew. But yeah, for Destiny 2, that's so like, I know. Okay, like the enemy team has like three hunters that all have the fucking like Arcstrider class on, and two of them have their supers charged. Having that information available to the player is such a fucking game changer to me.
It's a really slick UI.
Yeah, that it makes it so that like I'm not taken by complete surprise every time there's a super on the field. If you are paying attention to the information presented to you, you know who has supers when, you know what kind of supers to expect, and that to me does so much to curb the like ridiculous chaos that the supers threw into the game
yeah.
in Destiny 1.
Should also say two more things. I think the maps are generally really good. My favorite one might be the one that's on Fellwinter Peak, which is the
yeah.
area from Rise of Iron. That was awesome.
That's good.
And then the other thing to note about Crucible is we're mostly talking about the quick play stuff. The competitive playlist, it's actually, I don't know if competitive is really the best word for it, because that makes it sound like it's ranked and stuff. It's
right.
not. It's just another way. It's games that are a little lengthier and a little more in-depth. And if you really like Crucible and are good at it, like that's a really good one to play, because there's stuff like survival and other things, and those tend to be really fun game types, and I've enjoyed that. And Destiny is the rare FPS that I actually would say I'm pretty good at, and I'm usually like at the top or near the top of my
yeah.
team. And so I really enjoy Crucible, and I think I can tell that it just feels a lot tighter. And I didn't realize it at first, but I think ultimately I think that might be a good thing, because we were all kind of relearning what this thing is.
Yeah.
And overall now, it's easily one of my favorite parts of the game. Probably the thing I look forward to the most when I go into it these days.
Yeah, because also one thing I really like thinking about balance is I always felt like the auto rifle was so, like, the weapon you needed in Destiny 1 Crucible. And in Destiny 2, like, every weapon I've used feels,
yeah.
like, totally viable. 100. Like, I mostly use the scout rifle and,
uh-huh.
and my pistol.
Yeah. No, and again, it's however you want to play it. If you're good with it, it'll probably work
yeah.
for you. So, yeah, so we should probably start wrapping this up. Destiny 2, we will obviously talk more about it in the weeks and months to come,
yeah.
and we're going to have DLC in December. It's going to be the first expansion,
yeah.
which will be cool. But It's a good game.
Yeah, it's just like talking about it makes me want to play it, which is the exact same way with Destiny 1. It's such a fun... Like, I just love... There's so many different ways to play it. And the one thing, like, before we exited this out, one thing I do want to highlight that I think is the biggest improvement in Destiny 2 is that experience of, like, instead of going and dumping into a Strike playlist or dumping into a Crucible playlist, you can just go to a planet and go around on that planet and have fun. And, like, go to public events and maybe you have some adventures you haven't finished up. Or go, like, do some of the challenges and go to, like, find, raid some of the lost sectors and go hit the public events. Just go find random bullshit that's on the map. There's so much more richness in those sort of, like, the patrol zones than Destiny 1 was something I dreaded ever having to go to because it was just a fucking terrible part of that game. And Destiny 2, like, that's the thing I've kind of spent my most time on in the endgame is just, like, going onto those planets and be like, I'm going to wrap up these challenges and do some public events and see what happens and just have fun with it and just kind of chill and hang out. And to me, that is the biggest improvement of Destiny 2, is that it has fulfilled that side of the game that was the most lacking in Destiny 1.
I think Destiny 2 has kind of become the best version of itself, at least in terms of core identity, if not how it's actualized in every area of it, which is that Destiny is not necessarily like the deepest game out there, but it is so much fun. It asks you to have fun with it. Yeah. It is just a very entertaining game to go play with enough depth to the gameplay and the different systems to keep you coming back. It's a very good social game. I don't think either of us have played the raid, but it sounds like that one is really cool. So, yeah, I mean, if you never played Destiny 1, this is a great place to start.
Yeah.
I would definitely recommend Destiny 2. If you have a PC, go for it. Go wild with that. But, like, this is, you know, this has been a long journey, as we talked about, and we chronicled all of it on this podcast. Yeah. This podcast is a history of Destiny, if you want to go into it. But, you know, I have a smile on my face most of the time I'm playing Destiny.
Yeah.
And I really like that it is there and part of the landscape right now on consoles. Yeah.
Destiny is a game I have gone back to time and time again since it came out in 2014, and I'm looking forward to keep on coming back to it because they keep on giving us good reasons to.
Yes, so that's Destiny 2. It's good. Another great game in a year of ridiculously great games. Next week is a rarity, Sean, because I don't think we have any major game releases before the next podcast. Yeah. Fuckity Christ.
Just get to sit for a little bit and play the games that we already have. I have a couple of games that I've downloaded on my console, like Neo, that I've wanted to play, that I've owned for a couple of months now, and just literally have not had time to go to.
Yeah, so I don't know what we're going to talk about next week. That's been really rare on this show for a while, but we'll find something. It'll be fun.
We'll find an excuse, yeah.
And it's good times.
I really need to go back and play some more Destiny 2 right now.